We'll call the meeting to order, and we have the Central Minnesota Manufacturing Association here, and so I'd like them to come up first and just give us a little presentation on what they think could help them to create jobs and what we can do to help, and keeping with my theme of Made in USA. Welcome to the committee, sir. Just identify yourself for the tape.
Okay, no. Excuse me. My name is Lester Engel. I'm the president of the Central Minnesota Manufacturing Association. I'm also the owner of a company known as Engel Metallurgical, among other things, and came here to try and give you some of our thoughts and inputs. We've surveyed our members and have got some feedback from those. Not sure how you want to do it. We can just sort of go through our list of items.
Go ahead.
And I think some of the big items we found among our members is this whole issue of, as everybody knows, the debate on health care. And I think the issue is everybody knows they got to try and deal with health care issues, but for the manufacturers, this is a huge area of uncertainty. And so then everybody's sort of like, wow, what's going to happen to my business, and what are the costs going to be for this health care scheme, whatever it is, when it comes out. I think the other one that's come up is the, and then you've heard most of these, is the banking. For the financing, capital for financing, and then I think there's been a number of issues that have surfaced, things about relative to the banking. One of the things we've uncovered is that when the federal government, with the recession, and they were going to fix the banking problems, they basically put new restrictions onto the banks. And what this has done is up their needs, their capital levels that they have to maintain. And basically what happened is that shut down lending, because the banks can't lend that money. They had a huge impact on the lending. So as the federal government's accusing the banks of being stingy and not loaning the money they gave them, they set up a set of rules that literally throttled the lending. And I realize, you know, this is not the federal government here, but we've discovered, I guess, there's a commissioner of banking inside the state. But somebody needs to look at this, because then what I've learned from the bankers is the bank examiners are showing up, and even though it's not law, they're encouraging the banks to have even higher capital percentages, which just makes it worse. And then for the banks, I don't know if you've seen this, but the federal deposit insurance, apparently when the banks had problems, that organization upped their rates. And one small bank, Rye Bank, they were paying $3,500 a quarter for their insurance premium. It's now gone to $51,000 a quarter. This comes right off the top. So this is all the money that could be available to businesses that are being consumed in other areas. So that's been one of the big areas that we had. I think there's a concern about the cap and trade legislation that's going on. And it looks like the killer there is that the risk that it'll increase energy costs. And I don't think our manufacturers, it's not like they're totally against doing the right thing, but it's a nightmare as to what you're going to do. Some of the others that we saw as positive that are going around are like the angel investment credits. And apparently this exists in neighboring states, doesn't exist here. And this looks like a really big item in terms of job creation for startup companies, because the folks that invest in those companies, the angels, really provide some high-risk capital to get these businesses going when they have a good idea. And I think that's another really big item in the whole thing. One of the other things that's come up is the whole issue, and I've told you this, told some of you this before, is the idea of manufacturing and this negative environment that's being generated about manufacturing. And what you see in the paper and the news, everybody reports how many jobs have been lost. No doubt about it. There's a lot of problems going on. But our survey of the manufacturers is they really expect to be there at the end of all this. They really don't see that they're going away. They've had to regroup. And what we really think you need is an effort that encourages people to be aware of manufacturing. And we've done that in our own organization in Central Minnesota. We had a tour of manufacturers when we realized that most of the residents in the region had never been inside any of these plants unless they worked there. And so these plants opened up their doors on a Saturday, and the whole general public got to tour them and find out that there were manufacturing jobs. They are making products, you know, maybe difficult times, but they are doing okay, and that these are job opportunities to get the training to get those jobs. And I really believe if you get that positive energy going, it's the same emotion that drives Wall Street. It always worries me that the Wall Street investors are driven by emotions, but it's really what it is. If they get frightened, they pull out. And I think when people look at jobs and they see manufacturing, I hear all this bad news, they figure, boy, I'll probably be laid off next. So guess what? They stop spending, and the next thing that happens is the economy gets worse. So, you know, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy in the whole thing. And I think, let's see what some of the others. One of the big items that we've had on the list all along has been the sales tax rebate to manufacturers on equipment. And this was supposed to be helped, and then it went back the other way. We have one of our members, it's an unbelievable story. Apparently the auditor from the tax department shows up questioning what they submitted for their rebate on the equipment they bought. And the auditor managed to spend an entire week there trying to go through all their records. And in the end, that required the company to have two employees work full-time for 2 weeks to try and finish all the little details that supposedly weren't quite right on the form. They eventually did get or waiting to get their money, but this consumed a huge effort out of the manufacturer. And these are the things that are just killers. And I think the other one is taxes. Everybody knows about that, to try and improve corporate taxes. I think there's also an issue about how you factor that into S-Corps of to help their tax return, because that feeds right back into their personal income taxes in those kinds of areas. One of the other items that we looked at is that we got a copy of the banking bill that's there, that that the House is looking to start a manufacturing loan project. And I guess the reaction of the manufacturers is it just doesn't seem like the right business for the state to go into is to go into the banking business. It's really questionable about where the returns will be. When I read the bill myself, I get concerned about how it will be administered, and actually start to believe that if you didn't really have some detailed rules about it, it wouldn't work in the first place. I mean, the state has to be willing to take second position on a loan, or the banks aren't going to finance the deal anyhow. So there's a lot of issues to that, and it seems like if we could just help the banks to change the rules so that they do have money to lend, that would be one of the biggest things we could accomplish for the financing to the businesses. So those are some of the things. I mean, we have a lot of projects that are going on in our organization. We work a lot with the education system, and that's another whole area of discussion. And so I think that's another big item too. And so we work with the high schools, the colleges, the STEM conferences, all these types of things to help finance those things as well as be involved in them to make them go. I mean, like the STEM conference at St. Cloud State, a year ago they had 400 kids show up. This past year we had 1,000 kids show up to the STEM conference. So to really get these kids excited about all these kinds of things. And Project Lead the Way, another program that we heavily support. So there's been just a lot of things going on. It's interesting that a lot of comments, you know, how to tell you this in a simple way is a lot of the businesses almost have sort of an attitude that if the government would quit messing with them, they'd be able to work their way out of this, and they are working their way out of it. So it's always tricky sometimes when you're helping somebody, you might not really be helping them. You know, and I think that's a concern of a lot of the manufacturers, because they're never sure where it's going to end up, and it's sort of frightening. So and I think those are most of the really big items on our list. You know, there's a general feeling of state needs to balance its budget, live within its means. You know, that's the way businesses have to work, and the business people sort of see it that way. And other than that, like I said, the big item I think is to create a program the public that sees positive messages about manufacturing. Because in the end, if they start to buy things, when you realize they represent 70% of the economy, if the people out, all the folks in the area don't start buying things, the economy is not going to improve. It's just not going to happen, no matter how much money you put into it. There's some issues came up in our discussions about tax credits for hiring people, stimulus money to hire employees. I think the pretty much unanimous response by all the business people is, it doesn't matter if you give me $50,000 for every employee I hire, if I don't have work for them, I'm not going to hire them. It's that simple. There's no future in hiring these people because I'm going to get some cash somewhere. And the businesses aren't going to do it. So they look at the program like, no, nice thought. Now, if you happen to be employing somebody at that moment and need somebody, this is like a bonus. But that's pretty much where it ends up at. So.
Well, thank you, Ms. Randall. I think Representative Poppy has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask a question about training. And you talked a little bit about the connection with higher ed and education. I just wanted to know about if higher ed has been meeting the training needs that you've seen or that manufacturers have seen.
Well, I think in our region, it's gone very well. The St. Cloud Technical College that's there, they really always understood this from day one. And so their programs are designed to train people for jobs where they need people. And so their placement is extremely high. I mean, close to 100% of their students get placed. St. Cloud State, which is the other big institution in there, has done much, much better. The new president is much more positive about meeting the community needs. If you've seen any of the articles in the papers, I mean, he realizes they're going to see a budget cut, and they've already identified programs that they would literally eliminate because they don't think they really meet the community needs for skills. And so I think they've made some major changes, and that's very positive about realizing that these universities, as much as you need to educate people, you need to be looking at what does the region need. And I think that's, in our area at least, has been going very well in the relationships we have with them. Like Central Minnesota Manufacturers Association, we have people on our boards from all those institutions, and they're heavily involved in our committee. So we spend a lot of time working with them. We've got businesses. We have a program we started now where businesses adopt high schools to work with them, explain what they need, to work with students so they get to experience these job possibilities that are out there.
Okay. Annie, Mr. Engel, how has there been any growth in the manufacturing industry in Minnesota, to your knowledge, or has there been a loss of jobs? Are you holding your own? And overseas competition with lower wages and benefits and not having the environmental laws, et cetera, is it harder and harder for you to compete, or don't you see that happening?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think, one, no doubt about it, there's been a loss of jobs, continues to be some jobs lost in our area. An example, though, that I think is just a classic example for a business. There's a business in our area. It's owned by Sterrett, the big manufacturer of hand tools, measuring instruments. It's called TruStone. What they make are granite surface plates. Okay? And this company, I mean, this is like one of the class acts for surface plates. And they employed, prior to the recession, employed about 130 people. And we were just over there the other day, and they had layoffs, and they had reduced their employee headcount. They're down to, like, I think it's about 45 or 48 people working there. So less than half are there. And I asked the person that manages the company, I said, well, how's it going? And he says, that's very interesting, because he says, right now our sales are almost back to where they were before the recession. And they have managed to recover from that. They've done a lot of very interesting things of added value to their products so that their sales, they drove their sales up. But basically what happened, you can either see the example as a sad loss of jobs or a phenomenal improvement in productivity. And what their experience has been now is they're starting to see orders come back that they had lost to China, because they're more competitive. And at the same time, everybody's starting to look at the transportation costs and all the other problems of getting high-quality products from China. And I think that's one of the more unique stories. Obviously, other companies have continued to struggle. But again, I think most of the manufacturers, it's like, you know, the idea that, no, they do see some light at the end of the tunnel and don't believe it's a freight train, and that things are improving. But I think what's everybody's comments are, they don't see the jobs coming back, the numbers of jobs, but they see business starting to improve. And I think that's going to be what happens. And that's why the education thing is so important, is that all the statistics show that as the jobs come back, the people that are needed for those jobs are not the people we have that were in the workforce before. They need additional training to have those skills to do those jobs. And so it's a really very close tie between the education system and training the workforce and, you know, having people for those jobs when they do come back.
Okay. Other questions then? Thank you very much for being here.
Okay.
Representative Bly, are you presenting House Call 2837?
Yes, sir. I have a testifier who's joining me here. I would like to move House File 2837, and actually I'm not sure what the target for this bill is or where it's supposed to be headed. So
Representative Bly, I don't believe there's a fiscal note that I'm looking at. So if you want it to go on its own, I believe as a policy committee, we probably just shouldn't have to go through finance. It didn't come through finance on the way here, if I'm not mistaken. So we could probably go right to the floor. So if you want to make that motion, that's fine.
Yes. I'll move this to the general register then.
Go ahead.
This is a bill that has to do with green chemistry and looking at the effects of hazardous and toxic substances in our environment, and wanting to make sure that when we make choices about the use of chemicals, we are using chemicals that are safer. This, I believe, will improve our environment as well as our health situation. And I'd like to have the testifier speak to the
Welcome.
I'm Kathleen Schuler. I'm with the Healthy Legacy Coalition. Mr. Chair, members, I'm co-director of Healthy Legacy. It's a statewide public health coalition dedicated to safe products made safely. Healthy Legacy has a diverse membership of 32 groups representing health-affected people, faith communities, health professionals, labor, parents, and others. We support the promotion of green chemistry to create safer chemicals, sustainable materials, and clean production. Basically, green chemistry is an approach to the design, manufacture, and use of chemical products to intentionally reduce or eliminate chemical hazards. So it's thinking about the product design up front instead of worrying about the toxic things that are put into the product on the tail end. Green chemistry is an essential element of a green economy. It helps protect the health of communities by reducing local pollution. It protects the health of workers by using safer technologies. It helps reduce climate impacts by reducing energy use. It reduces contaminants in our food and environment and creates safer products that reduce toxic exposures for everyone. It also helps to reduce local government costs and future environmental cleanup costs through toxic waste prevention. So we have lots of examples, both with Minnesota businesses and nationally, of businesses that are already doing this, that are thinking of ways to make safer products. For example, one company invented an effective fire extinguishing agent that eliminates the use of halon and uses water in combination with a surfactant. There's other companies are inventing high-performance automotive coatings that remove lead content and replace it with a more benign element. There's also many examples with the EPA. The Environmental Protection Agency has a Green Chemistry Presidential Award, and over 12 years, the EPA green chemistry companies have eliminated 1.1 billion pounds of hazardous chemicals and solvents and reduced the release of 400 million pounds of carbon dioxide to air and saved 21 billion gallons of water. So basically, this is just a common sense thing. It adds green chemistry to the definition of a green economy so that companies that focus on green chemistry would be eligible for the Minnesota Investment Fund and other grant programs. It's a modest step in promoting the adoption of safer chemicals, sustainable materials, and clean production. And it sends a message that Minnesota is a friendly environment for companies that want to invest in green chemistry research and innovation. Thank you.
Questions of the author or on the bill? If not, then Representative Bly renews his motion that House File 2837 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register.
Just for clarification, we did get a first committee engrossment out. That's the bill we're actually acting on, right?
Yeah, the language that the extra verbiage on the bill that was in the package has been changed. So this is the bill. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Were you intending to send this to the General Register rather than put it into your policy bill?
Yes. That's the request of the author. There's not much in the bill. I don't think it's controversial or there's no financial impact. So. Representative Mahoney?
Yeah. President Bly, and to the testifier, could you point me to where this puts it into the bioscience infrastructure grant program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I don't know if I can answer that question.
Chair Gavina and Representative Mahoney, I'm stepping in for Representative Knuth, who was called away for a family emergency. So I don't know. Was this bill heard in your committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bly, yes, it was heard in my committee. And my concern is that at this particular point, it will be the only named thing in that grant program defined as something. I mean, most of it's all pretty broad with bioscience, so it leaves it proprietary. So I have some concerns with it. I thought we might keep it as a part of the omnibus bill, but I'm only one member here, so I will keep my thoughts to myself on it, but just understand that at this particular point, you are now making yourself higher and more above any other kind of bioscience issue in the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the definition of a green economy refers to two places in statute, and those places are the following: 116J.575, grants that are administered by deed, and the second one is the Minnesota Investment Fund, 116J.8731. So I don't believe that wasn't referred to. The biosciences grants were not referred to in the definition of a green economy, to my knowledge.
Anita, could you give us maybe some advice here?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, this is done by cross-reference. There's a section 116J.437 is the statutory language that coordinates economic development and environmental policy, and this would add the green chemistry language there, so it would be associated by cross-reference to the other programs.
And Mr. Chair,
Again,
I voiced my concerns. I'm not going to hold up a member's bill over that. In the bonding bill, which hopefully will pass, we've expanded the bioscience to include proprietary technology, which would encompass this but not make this proprietary, which I think this particular bill might do. Again, I will hold my reservations and talk to Representative Knuth on the floor.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and the testifier. Could you just give us a two-part question? Could you give us examples of green chemistry? And then I know the Healthy Legacy is a group that's supporting this bill. They call this an interim step. So what would be the next step then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer. Interim step simply means that we can do a lot more to promote green chemistry. We can provide technical assistance through our state agencies. We can provide additional research. We can beef up our academic programs. We can provide product stewardship. There's lots of things you can do to promote green chemistry. This is just a little step. It's just adding green chemistry to a current definition of green economic development, which includes things like positive impacts on climate change, energy efficiency, promoting biofuels, protecting Minnesota waters. It's just one additional criteria added to that definition.
Okay, any further questions? If not, then Representative Bly renews his motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. And Representative Bly, if you'll come and chair the meeting, I'll...
Be right there.
Chair, if I could take up, since the manufacturing folks are here, House File 3037 first.
Go ahead and
Ms. Novak has informed me that I need an amendment, so I would move to amend 3037 on page 2, line 21. Delete legislative appropriations. And the reason why, Mr. Chair and members, is Ms. Novak informs me that I can screw up the revenue bonds by having that language in there. Then they wouldn't become revenue bonds, and they would become general obligation bonds. And so that wasn't the intent. The intent of the bill, members, and you know, we had hearings through the fall on trying to create jobs, jobs task force committee, and one of the hearings we held, when it was my turn as a tri-chair, I guess, we held a hearing up in Malacca and had some of the folks testify. And one of the testifiers, Mr. Backshelder from Bemidji, had testified about the fact that if he could just get a loan or a grant or whatever to buy a piece of equipment, it would have made his business a lot more profitable. But because of the things Mr. Engel referred to in trying to get banks to loan money right now, whether it's because of federal action or just the times or whatever, it's been more and more difficult. So, you know, I was thinking of ways we could do this without, I guess, bankrupting the state. And I thought if we could issue some revenue bonds and pay back the revenue bonds, perhaps those businesses paying them after they start making money off that equipment in that grace and give them a grace period, which this bill does, of up to 2 years before they have to start paying it back, that it would be a good policy for the state to have. And so basically that's what the bill does. I think this bill has to be re-referred, Mr. Chair and members, to Capital Bonding Committee that wants to see because of the bonding issues. So, you know, after that, I don't know if you want to...
Do you want to move the amendment that you
vote
made?
Vote on the amendment. I made that oral amendment. So,
any questions about the amendment? Seeing none. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
And then, Mr. Chair, now I'd like to move 3037 as amended, then be passed and re-referred to Capital Bonding.
Any questions? Seeing none. All those in favor say aye.
But aye.
Opposed?
Oh, is that on the bill?
Sorry?
Because yes. I have my hand up here.
Oh, I didn't see it.
Yeah, that's all right.
Excuse me, Representative Anderson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rukavina, I apologize that I came in late here. On this issue. So what happens if the manufacturing firm isn't able to pay back the loan?
Well, there's a number of, and that's why it's going to Capital Bonding, because there are a number of safeguards in here that it isn't the moral obligation of the state to pay them back. But I would ask my counsel expert on bonding, you know, how that is handled then, but I know that it isn't a state obligation to pay that back, which it isn't on other revenue bonds. So, Ms. Novak, help me out on this.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson,
There are a couple areas in the bill that deal with repayment, and one is subdivision 3 on page 3, and it says that the only source of money to repay the loans are revenue credited to the account. And with the amendment that went on, the only way that they get money into that account is by selling revenue bonds and payments of on the loans that are made. So it is not a general obligation of the general fund or the state taxpayers. And then there's another subdivision that specifies clearly that this is not an obligation of the taxpayers, and that's subdivision 5. If a loan goes into default, the cost, I believe, would be spread among the other people making loans in the future from that account.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Ms. Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rukavina, I want to commend you for this bill. In your dueling policy committee this morning, the Bioscience and Workforce Policy Committee, it was pretty obvious. We had heard from a company that moved to Wisconsin because Wisconsin has this particular program, although we have one that's somewhat similar. Wisconsin was able to pretty much make up the $200,000 loan, whereas Minnesota was only able to come up with about $25,000 because of some ratios that we have and the actual dollars we put into it every year. We have to get very creative because the competition among states, and it's not just Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, all have a program a little different here, a little different there, but they have one of these manufacturing loan programs, and it's I commend you for the capitalist in you. I'm learning to new things about you every day.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, I have professed many times to not be the best world's best capitalist, particularly at the Capitol. But what I'm trying to do is, you know, you see the news recently, and knowing the number of people that are laid off in this state and collecting unemployment insurance, and then seeing in the paper the other day of the poverty that's beginning to show up in the suburbs, where you had 40% increases in food stamps in some of our, what we all thought were our very, you know, in areas that we didn't think it would ever occur, and the reduced and free lunch program in places that we never expected in school districts, all of a sudden increasing 30% to 40%. And so I trying to figure out a way to help maybe with our manufacturing base, which has always been very important to me. I want to make things in the USA. I won't get into my union-made suit or my underwear being made in the USA, although I'll get it on the market. But anyway, I want to help out here. These are the good livable wage jobs, and this basically bill needs to be looked at in the bonding committee and look at a way that it maybe can be made to work better. But I think with that grace period and the bill allows extra bonds to be issued to cover that grace period, that maybe it could be utilized by some of these manufacturers in the room, and maybe it couldn't be, but we got to try. So,
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rukavina, I'm just there's a couple of things that I'm just looking at here, and maybe you could tell me, is there language in here that talks about who qualifies for these loans?
Ms. Novak, there is some criteria that's going to be set up by the commissioner, and I assume that in there is that, but I don't know for sure what line where that is at, Ms. Novak.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, I believe the criteria are embedded on page 2 in subdivision 3. It establishes a process in which the commissioner solicits proposals for loans under this bill and establishes criteria for granting the loans.
Okay, I guess I saw that, and that's but that's all I thought that was in there. But I guess my question is there, I mean, I think from what we hear from the financial markets is today is there really is not a shortage of money. It's that the it's more difficult to borrow. What in the bill, or is this the piece in the bill that's going to keep people who would qualify for the vehicles that are out there for private financing from just coming in and taking advantage of cheaper financing that's provided by the state?
Well, and I don't know if the guarantee is that it's cheaper. It's just that it's got a grace period here, and maybe hopefully, you know, our businesses will be able to get some capital that they need to exist. In my experience with some of the businesses in my district right now, small businesses representing Eastland, they're just very, very nervous about the fact that they're barely hanging on and they can't get capital anywhere. And, you know, I've had folks that have gone to try to get an SBA loan or just get a loan in general, and it's tight out there. Mr. Engel referred to it. And I don't, you know, whether the cause is the new regulations put on by the federal government or the fact that the banking industry is somewhat in disarray, I don't know the answer to that. Like I said, I'm not an expert on banking to be very kind to myself, I would say that. And so what I'm just trying to do is come up with some ideas to try to help our manufacturing industry and keep it going and possibly, you know, create some more jobs in that area. This bill definitely needs work. I'll be the first to admit it, and that's why I'm referring it over to Ellis, Commissioner, or to Ellis Halsman's Capital Bonding Committee to take a closer look at it. But if you've got a way to fix it up or a better idea, I'd be more than happy to entertain it.
Well, I'd rather just ask questions, Mr.
Okay.
So I guess my first concern is the criteria that there is something in here so that this is going to go to the people that you're intending it to go to. If people can qualify for loans just in the private market, they should be going there. But what I was reading was under loan term subdivision 4 there on line 213. It says any loan under this section must be issued at the lowest interest rate required to recover the principal and the interest plus cost of issuing. So my sense here is that this is going to be issued at a rate lower than the marketplace, if that's the case. I mean, I don't know. That, so there should be some kind of criterion in there so that it doesn't just become a place where people who could qualify for private loans can just go and get a cheaper rate. The question I've got is what I've heard in most of the private marketplace is that the loan to value ratio is what's killing people. I mean, they're requiring people to come up with a bigger down payment. And I noticed in your bill here it says that on line 1.24 it says loans under this section are intended to cover up to 50% of the cost of the project. So I mean business or the manufacturer is going to have to provide 50% of the capital. So we're requiring 50% down, which seems like kind of a high number. It seems like that number would fit into the private marketplace. If somebody would put that much down, there's people out there that are willing to lend money. Just another kind of an observation that I've got here that I thought was interesting.
Chair and Representative Eastland, you know, being a good businessman yourself, I'm more than happy to lower that number and take some of your advice on this as it moves forward. Again, no one can deny the economy we're living in right now and the pressures on particularly small business. And quite frankly, I don't see the federal government with all of their proposals and federal dollars really helping small business. We've helped a lot of people that I think businesses that maybe caused this part of this giant recession that we're in. We help them out, but we're not helping out the Mr. Engels and that of the world, and that's who I was just trying to try to do something for them with this bill. It's not perfect. It needs work. But we have to talk about the fact that these small businesses, particularly the ones that create wealth like the manufacturing industry does, need help right now.
Mr. Chair, one more.
Do you have another question?
All right. Yeah, one more question. I appreciate that. I understand that that's your intention in the bill. I guess I'm just concerned that if it's going to do what you think it's going to do, somehow it needs to be tightened up so it's targeted at that group of people. And then the question is how do we make sure we have a good investment so that we minimize liability of loss? And I guess the one thing that I am seems a little bit unusual to me in here also is on line 2.15, where it says the term of the loan must be for a minimum of 15 years. And it gives an out there for the commissioner to determine the shorter. But I don't know what these loans are going to be used for. My sense is that they're going to be used for equipment or different kind of things to operate that are, you know, operating in production. It seems like 15 years might be a pretty long number. But maybe that's what it has to be so you can get the repayment rates down. I don't know. But it just seems like that's kind of a long period of time for what I would expect most of the uses of this loan would be.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Eastman, and that's why I gave the commissioner the ability to determine if it was shorter. But, you know, I'd really like to work with the industry itself to see if we can make this thing better eventually as it moves along. So just give me a chance to get it out here, get it over to capital bonding and see if we can fix it up. Because I think the need is there. How we address the need is the question.
Representative Anderson. Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is a question that you can answer, Representative Rukavina, or if Ms. Novak can answer this one. Do we know, will this have any impact on the state's bond rating at all? Or
I don't believe it does at all because of the fact that the revenue bond.
Okay, Ms. Novak?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, it will have no, in my judgment, it will have no direct effect on the state's bond rating. It does have, under the new bond guidelines, one of the guidelines counts all debt outstanding, including revenue bonds, and it would have some impact on that.
Does that answer your question? All right. No further questions.
Mr. Chair, is it okay if we would have the fellow from manufacturing here comment on?
I'm not in charge anymore.
His thoughts on the bill here?
Would you like to make a comment, sir? Would you like to make a comment?
Well, I think, like I indicated,
is there anyone?
Okay.
Listen, you're going to get on the hot seat with me. You've got to get down over here.
How do we do this? But yeah. So, hi. Again, Lester Engel. The Central Minnesota Manufacturing Association, and I think I read the bill. I actually looked at it, and like I said, we ended up with maybe the state shouldn't be in the banking business, which I think is a little bit of what you're saying. I think the concept for the need sounds good, but what I read in that bill, it doesn't stipulate what the max amount of the loan would might be. It does say 50%, which you already brought up, which creates a problem because probably most businesses, if they had 50% of the money to put down, it's a no-brainer to go to the bank and get the money, the rest of the money. So it means then that your loan program, you have to be willing, like the SBA, to take a second position. Because if I want to go borrow $400,000, and if your loan cap is $200,000, you'll pay half of this, so I get the $200,000. If I go to the bank and I negotiate for the other $200,000, or whatever it is, they want first position on that loan. And if you say, well, we don't want to risk our money, so we want first position on the loan, this becomes an instant impasse that can't work. I mean, the bottom line is that the deal will be dead because the bank can't be in second position. And it's interesting, like other sources of funds that we have for manufacturers, is like the Initiative Foundation and the one in central Minnesota area. And so they will do gap lending, and they're willing to take a second and third position in that loan, which means they're buying a bigger risk if you do that. And so the question is whether you start to adjust this thing so it really is a help and really works. The way I read it, it left a lot of that up to, I assume, the commissioner, whoever it is that runs it. And if they get very conservative, they won't look any better than the bank in terms of deciding what to do. And I think the idea that it's there to help at first blush is a good idea, but it's really critical about how you lay that out so that you know that it can really help the manufacturer. Because like I say, if you end up, you want the first position on the loan, unless the manufacturer's got the other 50%, the deal is dead.
Thank you. Without
and,
any...
And Mr. Chair...
Go ahead.
To that point, and Representative Eastland brings up a good point. You know, where I come from, we have the Iron Range Research and Rehabilitation Board, an agency, and we've got local property taxes that were diverted to that agency from the mining companies, and we jump into those positions, and in fact, we have that, and I was looking for some type of way for other places of the state that don't have an agency like that to come up with some money to take a little risk. You are 100% right, and when we structure some of those loans, we have bank participation loans out of that agency, we call it, where we take a little more of the risk, and you'll have an initiative fund jump in, and some of those block grants that come to some of your rural districts from the federal government that fill in those gaps, and that was, this was just looking for a way for another tool, and if we need to adjust it, good. Where the heck were you when I was drafting it, Bill?
You know, you need to call
me. I tried. We tried. Believe me. So I'm glad you showed up today.
Yeah. But no, I think it's a good thing. It's just you really need to lay those things out so it's clear, because the person that's left in charge of that loan scheme, you're basically going into the banking business.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hawes.
Thank you very much. I think I hear one of the things I hear about government help to businesses is that we continually help businesses that do not need help, and that they would go along, they would do it very well on their own. So the risk factor, I think, is important. If you want government to really be helping, you have to take some risk for those that could not do it on their own. And I think that's a portion of what we should at least be attempting to do.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, anyone else from the audience wish to testify to the bill or comment?
I have one last comment.
All right, Representative Eastland.
You know, I understand Representative Rukavina's desire to move this thing forward, but I guess, I mean, how do we fix it? You know, other than just assume it's going to get fixed down the road. I guess I think the concept has some merit, but I just have some real concerns about what's going on in here, and I'm not prepared to sit here and fix it today. But I mean, is there some way we could start a process so that you could work with the manufacturers and we could make this thing focus in a little bit more on where you intended it to go so it could work, rather than just pass it on to the next committee?
Representative Eastland, I think Representative Rukavina has made it clear that he's more than willing to work with folks to get it into
shape. And Representative Hausman wants to see this because it deals with bonding and, you know, to move it there and hopefully try to work on it or maybe not do anything at all with it. What might be the result? But, you know, in the times we're living in, I was just hoping that we could make it easier for small Main Street businesses and the manufacturing base that we still have in this state that a lot of people ignore that. I think this is still a very strong base that we could help them out. So. It'll have a lot of scrutiny, and it may not go much anywhere, but you and I can sit down, because I know what a good capitalist you are, and we can work on it some more, okay? That's my promise to you.
Okay, Representative Rukavina renews his motion to move House File 3037 to the Capital Investments Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Mr. Chair, if I could do House File 3448 next.
Very good.
Again, another issue. And so I'd move House File 3448 and just be held over for possible inclusion. And I want to start off by saying that I know on this bill, members, that I think Representative Mahoney has a similar bill that he's working on that's somewhat broader than this, if I'm not mistaken. This deals just particularly with a pilot project with the Minsky system to try to leave a little bit money locally, that some of their reserves locally in local banks and financial institutions, so that that money could be used and again in these tight times to possibly loan out to a manufacturer or whomever. So you know, this is just a bill that I put together from comments that, again, we received from small business people when we were having the jobs task force. This is one of the things. And, again, Representative Mahoney, if I could ask him, I don't know where his bill is at right now, if it's coming here or did it go somewhere else. But that's a little broader version. This just kind of targets in on some of the dollars that, the reserve dollars that are at our different Minscu systems around the state that we try to keep local.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, my bill is in the Finance Committee and has been referred down to State Government Finance. And yes, mine's much broader, and you know, you're not the only one who gets interviewed by the Wall Street Journal.
I didn't, Mr. Chair, I didn't get interviewed by the Wall Street Journal. I got blasted by the Wall Street Journal. But I blasted them back and had comments from all over the country, so that was my response.
My bill is moving here and in the Senate.
So, Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's any real big questions. I think there are people that might want to comment on this, or maybe not. And I don't know if Minsky wants to comment on the bill at all. But
and where's this bill headed next?
I would just hold it over, Mr. Chair, as my motion for possible inclusion.
Okay. We have a testifier coming forward. Would you please
Mr. Chairman, my name is David Skillbred, Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, a statewide association of community banks, privately held institutions, all of the banks in our association. Approximately 71% of the more than 400 chartered banks in Minnesota are S-Corps, or small businesses. They are local bankers making local decisions with a local commitment. ICBM would like to support House File 3448. There are some details that we think need refining, but we believe it goes in the right direction insofar as it takes a step forward to decentralize state deposits and move those deposits closer to the origin and to the people that made them so that they may be better leveraged to support those communities from where they come. We're here today, and as the chairman said, because we had some meetings last fall about our economic condition, and we're looking at ways to try to improve our state's economy. I want to suggest that when it comes to supporting small businesses, when it comes to maintaining, preserving small businesses, helping them get started or to expand, small banks are doing more than their fair share. One way, not the only way, I admit, but one way to measure that support is to look at data from the Small Business Administration as it regards who is making SBA loans. In 2009, according to the SBA, the Minnesota District Office ranked first in the nation in the number of SBA loan guarantees and fifth in the nation in dollars of loan guarantees out of 68 district offices nationwide. I would contend that part of the reason for those results is because Minnesota has the third highest number of chartered banks in the country, over 400, and that diversity or density and the fact that they too are small businesses help us lead the nation in this area. So what are those facts about SBA loan activity? In 2009, 264 Minnesota lenders combined to make 2,482 small business loan guarantees to small businesses in Minnesota. Those loan guarantees had values of $524.3 million. According to the recent FDIC summary of deposits for Minnesota banks, the three largest depository banks, with 426 offices in the state, have a market share equal to 48% of all deposits, or $48 billion, while the three largest depository institutions have a market share equal to 48%. When you look at the SBA loans that they made, they combined to make 12.5%, or 312 of those 2,482 loans. The dollar share for those amounts was 11.5%, or $60.1 million of the total $524.3 million. The other 261 small lenders made 87% of all loans, or 2,170. The dollar amount equaled 464 million of that 524 million. As I said before, there are other ways to measure loan activity. There's certainly other small business loan activity taking place, but SBA loan activity is a good barometer or measure for small business loan activity. Specifically regarding this bill, I'd like to say that regarding the timeline goes, it might be a little bit aggressive, so we'd like to work a little bit on that. The designation of the miles, we'd like to see all those line up with institutions around the state. And the community financial institution definition, as the chair said, Representative Mahoney has a similar bill, and there's a similar definition in that bill. So we'd like to see those two definitions be parallel. But in conclusion, I would like to say that ICBM supports this bill. We believe it goes in the right direction. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Skilford. Representative Nornes, you had a question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, I'm just trying to figure out here, where is the money kept now? Where is it deposited? Does this make some reference to the state treasury, so the state has possession of that?
Mr. Chair, we have some comments to, maybe Ms. Novak can help me, but I think a lot of it gets deposited in the state treasury and gets managed on a daily basis or whatever. And so it probably gets deposited in some of the bigger banks, in the area or whatever. So you tell them where it goes.
Okay. Judy Borgen with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Currently, yes, our money does go into the state treasury, the money that's being talked about here. There are certainly local bank accounts that we do have at some of our institutions for activity funds and things like that, but the money that's being talked about here is in the state treasury.
Mr. Chair, one other question or follow-up.
Representative Nornes.
You had references a community financial institution, and this is a pilot, I understand that, but if, for example, my community was selected and we have like 9 banks, the discretion would be up to the local college then to determine where to deposit the money?
Under this, that it would maybe be up to the local college in the area. And I don't know if there's a sign-off by the Board of Trustees. I can't remember if I put it is.
Okay. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Rukavina, I'd like to amend your bill. On page 2, line 11, and this is the part of the bill where you're asking the MMB to do a study. On line 11, you have evaluate the effectiveness. I would suggest that you put in or harm, so that we could find out if it does good or does bad. And then it would match up to the study language in my bill.
You got that. Mr. Chair, I take that as a friendly amendment. I just want the evaluation to see if it's doing any good or not.
Okay.
So I would accept that motion just as a friendly amendment.
Okay. Do we need to vote on? Okay.
I believe Ms. Novak will incorporate it in.
Thank you. All right.
And Mr. Paul. Chair,
yes.
If I could, since Representative Mahoney's bill is moving on its own in GovOps, and I assume it's going to go on its own into to full finance,
yes.
If I could change my motion to do the same, then that this bill be recommended pass and referred to full finance committee.
Very well. Yeah.
I don't know what kind of policy is going to be in our omnibus bill this year. If I had my way, there'd be a lot of it, but I don't know if I'm going to have my way. So.
Okay. I believe we have another testifier. Is that right? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jim Conrad. I'm president of University Bank. It's part of the Sunrise Community Banks, which is comprised of Park Midway Bank, Franklin National Bank and University Bank, and we are a group of three financial institutions in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area with a focus on the urban community, and we appreciate a chance to comment today on this proposed bill 3448. We support the spirit of what this is intended to do. I think there's never been a more important time with the challenges that are being faced in our country and in our local communities for strong collaborative efforts to occur between the private, the public, and the nonprofit sector. That is an area we feel very strongly about, and we think this is an opportunity for many new collaborations to be formed, to think out of the box a little bit, to look at old assumptions and old procedures and maybe explore different ways where we can all make an impact on the challenges that our economic community faces. As a financial institution, we grew 13% last year, so we are strongly committed to this community. We continue to lend, and a core deposit base is an essential part of any successful financial institution. Banks can always seek out expensive, high-priced, non-local deposits, but that is not a fundamental way to run a successful banking institution. It needs to rely on core local deposits. And we think in many of the communities that local banks serve, whether it be with Minscu institutions, many family members, employees, students are already participating or customers of many of these banks in the local community. So there's already a bond there, and I think there's an opportunity to have this bond increase and improve even more. And to the extent that the state and Minscu can consider ways to put core deposits, operating accounts with local financial institutions, I think it's a healthy opportunity to get even closer bonds established within these communities and work together with financial institutions to deliver loans that are desperately needed right now. Again, we're very happy to say that we did grow last year by a significant amount, and we are very supportive of the spirit of this bill in looking at other avenues to help support community banks.
Okay, thank you. I do have a few questions I'd like to recognize here. President Hawes.
Thank you. I don't know who the question goes to, but probably staff, maybe. When there's raids on local college reserves or on allotments or withdrawals, whatever we call that process of taking money away from people, if they take this from the state treasurer to the local banks, does that restrict or protect those reserves in any manner?
Ms. Nova.
Mr. Chair, perhaps Minsky can tell us what the procedure is now, but I think, you know, there was some short-term borrowing on their reserves, which came from St. Cloud and St. Yes. Paul Community and Technical College and, you know, the Northeast Higher Education District and every other place and, you know, the legislators in this room. And the short-term borrowing occurred. I don't think, but I could, if Minsky wants to come back and comment on it, that, you know, it would affect it really one way or the other, because this money would not make its way to St. Paul and would be deposited locally, and probably as far as short-term borrowing would be concerned in dealing with the unallotments or the budget crisis we're in, it would maybe be a little safer, but I don't know. Oh, you're going to interpret it.
Ms. Bork.
But, Mr. Chair, I'm on a run here. I got two bankers in a row to actually like a bill. So, you know, I mean, we should just get this out of here as quickly as possible.
I don't want you to crush your luck.
Ms. Bork, I could withdraw my question.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Hawes. This money, I would believe, although I would think that MMB would be a better to speak to this, but I would assume it's no longer in the state general fund. It would be in a local bank account. It would be very hard. It then is no longer in what they call the statutory general fund. Therefore, I assume that the money would not be available for them to use on a cash flow basis.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hawes.
Author Mrkovina. I like it more that way. You know.
I do have Representative Eastland, Representative Anderson, I do understand that someone from the Office of MMB would like to come up and make a statement. Maybe this would be a good time to do that. Can your questions wait until after we hear from them?
Okay.
Not another banker, right?
No, management budget.
Okay. Good, I hope you're opposing.
Your streak's alive.
Hi, Joe Howe. I'm the Director of Operations, Treasury, Minnesota Management and Budget. And I just, not here to oppose or support, just wanted to do a quick point of, point of clarification. Currently, the money, Minsky money goes into whatever accounts they do, they deposit into locally, and we every day go in and sweep or pull the funds out of the account and send that money to the State Board of Investment to invest every day. So that would be interest earnings that would be lost in the general fund that are currently there.
Thank you. Representative Eastland.
You can stay up there then, because this may be, my question has something to do with that. I guess, first of all, just a general question, how much money are we talking about in this pilot program? I mean, what is the total amount? Roughly a range, you know, depending on who's chosen, but what is the amount that we...
Well, it's a pilot program, so we're not specifying an amount there. I guess that would be, again, be determined by the Board of Trustees and to determine what to put into a pilot program. But the intent, again, is to leave some of that money that's created locally to stay locally and to be used by the community for whether it's borrowing for a new piece of equipment or whatever. So I don't have a dollar amount on here at all. And I don't know if Representative Mahoney has a specified dollar amount in his bill.
Representative Mahoney?
To this point, Mr. Chair, I don't have a specified amount. I specified the ability for the state, all the state funds, so long as the community banks can manage the workload. But I would suggest that you might want to ask the Minsky person what their average account is. I mean, I don't know. I guess the question would be better framed, what size institutions are you talking about?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, and that would be determined again, but my understanding is, you know, the reserves range in the million to higher. I would assume no more than $25 million for a private program statewide, but, you know, there are different size reserves. If you're talking about St. Cloud State or St. Paul Community Technical College or the NEAT system, so.
Ms. Borg.
That's very correct. I mean, we have, as we're looking at reserves, and that's one of the questions we have, I think there's a number of questions with the bill, exactly what do various words in the bill mean, and reserves, we're thinking of it as our board required reserves, the amount that our institutions do not intend to spend in a given year. That amount of money ranges anywhere from $300,000 up to over $7 million. So it would very much depend upon what institutions were chosen, whether eight institutions were chosen or whether four institutions were chosen given the bill. So it could be very small. It could be, as you said, about $25 million maybe if we chose fairly large institutions.
President Eastland?
To the other testifier there, you said that currently you sweep the accounts and pull it into the state jurisdiction, and then it's invested in the state board. The investment is managed by the State Board of Investment.
Correct. We manage the cash position. The expenditure is what comes.
Okay.
In.
Okay. So I guess
we send it to SBI.
I guess what kind of return on investment is that bringing? And does that return on investment go to the institution, or does that kept by the state, or how does that work?
Sure.
go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, the return on investment, I couldn't answer that right now, and especially the funds and that. That would probably be better served there. I'm sorry, what was the second part to your question?
Where does it go? Where does the return on investment go?
Sorry.
Is that a state in the purview of the college, or does that follow the funds that are being invested, or does that just come out and does that go to the state?
When we pull the money out of every account across the state and SBI invests it, that goes into the general fund, so it goes into the earnings for the agencies, for all state agencies. It goes into the...
So
that earning does.
So it does not follow, it does not benefit the institution.
that investment earning on,
yes,
on money that's in the state treasury, you know, that goes.
Okay. Maybe there's more clarity.
Okay, I'll try to answer at least from the point of view of Ninsku. We have currently, I asked this morning what our interest earnings are on our on the monies that we do receive based upon the tuition and fees that we collect, not upon the state appropriation, but on the part of the revenue that's in the state general fund. We are in a separate fund from the general fund. We are in the education 105 numbered fund. That fund, with the revenue that we generate within that, we receive interest on that every month, and it's now at a little under, I think it's a 0.0485%, so we're a little under a half a percent in terms of the interest earnings that we're getting on a monthly basis. It certainly has been much higher in the past. Right now, it is not. That interest is money that accrues back to the system. This year we're looking at probably gaining about $2.5 million in interest earnings. In other years when interest rates have been much higher, we have gotten in the $5 to $6 to $7 million range.
Okay, I have about a minute left for our committee hearing, and I have two questions here, one from Anderson, Representative Anderson, Representative Nornes. Can you be brief, please?
I will do my best. I have several questions, but just quickly. So if we go to this system, and this is for the woman from Minsky, I apologize, I can't remember her name. If we go to this system and we're investing smaller amounts in the different banks, will that impact the interest earning potential for us? Because it's not as large of a pool based versus now State Board of Investment has a larger chunk, I assume, to work with. Have we looked at that at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we have not had a chance to look at that, means this bill has just been introduced yesterday. Okay. But that is one of the questions that we have, and our thought was maybe there's a number of questions that need to be answered so before this thing would be implemented. So perhaps maybe a study of those questions and get that out on the table and a delayed implementation as a possibility.
Okay,
but definitely that would be one of the things that would come in from the institution working with its local bank could tell us what kind of an interest earnings we would have.
Thank you.
And then just quickly, Representative Rukavina, if a school working with their local financial institution isn't able to get a comparable rate, is there a you're let off the hook type of language in the bill? I couldn't see if there was, and I'm just if they aren't going to maximize that earning potential, are they exempted then from this requirement?
First.
And then I know it's a pilot project, but it doesn't say how many. It just says one from, yeah, it says
up to eight.
I missed.
So it is a pilot project. It's 4 to 8 pilots around the state, and Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I don't know right now if the actual interest that we were talking about here that does accrue and gets stayed in that fund, if it goes back to that particular institution or not. It does.
It will in the future. It's part of our base now. In the future, we are sending it directly back to that institution.
So in the future, but
yep. Mm-hmm.
Not
in the present. Today, it's just part of the basic dollars that we allocate to the institution, so they benefit from it, but not specifically for their share of the amount.
So that's a good point, because I didn't think it specifically went back to that institution in the form of what they made off of it. In this way, and I don't know if the banks have time to comment, but you know, their interest rate has to be at least somewhat comparable to 0.0438%.
Okay, thank you.
Chair, I'll pass. Renew my motion that it be referred to full finance.
Okay. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just be on the record as having recused myself to avoid any possible conflict of interest on this bill. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd like to deposit this in Representative Downey's bank.
Second.
Division.
all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Okay, and at this time, I think we'll call the meeting adjourned. Oh, wait, yes, please put your unheard bills in your back in your folders, and we'll pick them up at 4:30.
Chair, so we will be recessing until 4:30, and I'm hoping that we can continue with a number of these bills. I may take the Mead bill off of the agenda for tonight, as much as I don't want to. But we have another number of other bills
yes.
that we're on this evening. So
we are recessed until 4:30 at 400 South.
Okay. If we could, it's kind of crowded in here, and I apologize for that. But Representative Mahoney moves the minutes of the
last two meetings.
Thursday, March 4th, and we'll vote on that first. Any additions or corrections? Not all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. And Representative Mahoney, on Wednesday, January 27th, we...
I remember that day just perfectly.
Yes, that was the meeting that we had, I think, on a number of
bonding
bills.
Yeah, I remember it.
Any additions or corrections? Representative Eastland, I think we gave you money. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Norton moves that House File 3048 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion.
For to the floor.
Well, we'll do it.
Yeah.
Both ways.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have an amendment, an author's amendment. It's the A10-2255. It's mostly technical in nature, non-controversial. And we have someone from the Department of Labor and Industry here to explain it if you'd like further.
Mr. Joy.
Mr. Chair, committee members, these modifications on page 3 puts the language back. We had some stricken language on line 3.16. We need to have it back in there so it references that either the duties and functions comply with prescribed in this chapter, number one, and number two, the federal code of regulations, to make sure we cover both in that language. And page 21, after line 15, we're inserting an effective date in House File 927, which was a carryover of last year bill that was passed earlier, had some language relating to the certification of the medical gas criteria, and it referenced August 1st of 2009, and we're already past that date, so they can't get their certification in time to qualify. So this would move the date out to August 1st, 2010, to make sure we can qualify to get their certification to do medical gas.
Representative Norton, is the amendment A10-2301?
2301, yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Norton moves the A10-2301 amendment. Is there any questions on it? Not all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. That motion prevails. Representative Norton, to the bill then.
Yes, Mr. Chair. This bill's been through two Commerce Committees and Representative Mueller's Committee last evening. It's the Department Agency Bill for the Department of Labor and Industry. It's been vetted by BAM, the Minnesota Pipe Trades, contractors, industry, and union reps. There's no opposition. And the bill primarily deals with construction code, labor standards, and apprenticeships. There is, of course, a walkthrough I'd be happy to do. That's been done before in another committee, so I guess I would prefer just to take questions if folks have them. But if you'd like more than that, I would give it to you.
Well,
the department is here.
Are there any questions from members on the bill? And I see Mr. Crimmins is here, Mr. Lechtel. Industry rep. There's no opposition. Someone from the chamber want to talk against it? So my fear always is, in looking at the small changes that everybody says are small changes, that the small changes end up being more than technical in nature. So. Everybody that this affects is comfortable that this is what we want and no major significant changes that are going to eventually have somebody whining back in this committee asking us to change something they just did a year before.
And Mr. Chair, I went so far as to even look through all the repealers, and they all appeared quite safe. So, because I know sometimes that issue comes up.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's in here that's going to impact independent contractors?
Mr. Joachim.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I don't believe there's anything in here that addresses the issues relating to the independent contractors. We've changed, there's some clarification in regard to the contractor recovery fund, but that would apply to the licensed residential builders and remodelers.
What was that change?
On page 19. The one of the issues, Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the issues we had was we've had some judgments in condos and townhouses where the association should have been able to get a claim against the residential contract recovery fund, and it was vague or difficult for them to document it because the language specifically says the owner has to make the claim, and the owner of the condo or townhouse is different than the association. So we're clearing up language here that says if you are the owner, if the association is the owner, they can make a claim against the residential contract recovery fund for a roof damage or something to the commons area of the facility.
Okay. Representative, if there are no further questions, then Representative Norton renews her motion that House File 3048, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. I hate to do this, but I'm going to just for you because of your situation. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney is not here.
He's in the basement. We have to go get him.
Representative Clark is here.
You're supposed to go in.
I'll take then my bill, the House File 2810. And I'm just going to do it right from here, Member, if you don't mind. For that. And members, I have the Amendment DE3 that I would like to offer. And what the amendment does is basically addresses some concerns that small businesses had, or actually was brought to me by Mr. Krogman from the convenience stores and gas stations where there are just one or a couple or few employees. So I've tried to fix that up for him. I still don't know if he's that satisfied with it. But members, the reason for the bill is I had some calls, and other members had gotten calls about what we thought in law was a mandatory work break if you had 4 hours of work and worked a full 8 hours. And then I believe Mr. Wachowski, who disappeared now, I don't know where he is, and Representative Swigum, or former Representative Swigum, Commissioner Swigum, actually responded back to me. I think I had Ms. Newman call up and find out. And there really isn't, you know, the way it was that it was an employer must allow each employee adequate time. And there are some employees and businesses around the state where really weren't following the law. So this is an attempt to let somebody at least have a 15-minute break and go to the bathroom after 4 hours and have a work break or a lunch break after 8 hours. So I'll offer up the amendment to get it in order, and we can discuss the bill then. We have the DE3 amendment.
What bill are we on?
We're on 2810.
Sir.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, did you say a lunch break after working 8 hours?
Well, Rep, if you look at the amendment, Representative Murphy, right now, current law is, which you just read right there, an employer must allow each employee adequate time from work within each 4 consecutive hours of work to utilize the nearest convenient room, restroom, and nothing in this section prohibits an employer if it's collective bargaining. And then the current law goes on to read that meal break, an employer must permit each employee who's working for 8 or more consecutive hours at least sufficient time to eat a meal now. And that's the issue. We all thought that somebody got, you know, bathroom break after 4 hours and a lunch break in the middle when they work an 8-hour shift. But there's nothing really enforceable in law to enforce that. So that's what this is trying to do. I've tried to address some concerns for small businesses with the amendment, and so we'll vote on the amendment, then we can discuss the whole thing in general. I'll move the DE3 amendment. Can we move that, Representative Anderson, to get the bill in order before we pass? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Anderson, go ahead.
Does this mean that, say, for example, an employee wants to work through their meal break and their 15-minute breaks. If they get, say, they're a week working 8-hour day, they get their 15 minutes in the morning and they get the 15 minutes in the afternoon, and then they get 30 minutes break for lunch. Does this mean that they will no longer be able to work through that time because it's a leave day earlier in the day? Do you know how that would impact that?
Well, I don't know what kind of arrangement they have with the employer. If they have a union, they could, I suppose, negotiate something like your question, working straight through. If not, we get back to the question of, you know, are we going to let the employee have enough time to relieve themselves and get back to work and have a lunch break? Or are we going to leave it up to where I've gotten the complaints, an employer that really didn't allow that time? And so I don't know if it's permissive. I don't believe it is. I would ask counsel to, or Ms. Newman to help me out here, but I would say that, you know, unless that employer or employee brought a complaint or something that they, you know, had an agreement and they could leave early, that we're really not going to stop any private agreement between an employee and employer in that regard. But Representative Obermueller is a labor attorney, so he might give me a different opinion. And I just don't want to give any leeway anymore because it's the leeway in the current law that's causing the problem.
Right. And I'm just, Mr. Chair, in looking at this, I'm just concerned about the leeway for the employee. There's oftentimes, having managed people myself, and I myself as a former employee, know that it's nice if you can work through those breaks. Instead, so that maybe you can leave 30 minutes early for the day. Because you maybe have a doctor's appointment or something else that, going on that you want to leave for the day. And I just hope that we don't take away that flexibility because the company says, no, this is what state law says. I'd like to be able to let you leave early and, you know, have you work through your break, but now I can't. I hope that we aren't taking away that kind of flexibility.
And I don't want to either. I'm trying not to be, you know, a little quick, but I'm trying to provide for a wee-wee instead of leeway. So, you know, it's not working right now. And I don't think anyone at this table, regardless of their political persuasion, would think that somebody shouldn't be allowed to relieve themselves after 4 hours of work or take a lunch break in the middle of an 8-hour shift. None of us, I know, disagree with that concept. The problem is, according to Commissioner Swigum, and I asked Mr. Rakowski, there's what we have on the books right now really doesn't say that. So
I just hope that, Mr. Chair, as you're working on this bill, that we can make sure that the employee still has that kind of flexibility.
Yes, and I would like to see that, too. I don't think anything prohibits. Representative Obermueller, being involved in labor law a little bit, do you think there would be anything that would stop an employee or an employer from having an agreement? I get to go off early today because I had to pick up the kids and I work through my lunch break.
Mr. Chair, and I don't think it has anything to do with me being doing labor work, but the bill actually says you must allow an employee to take the 15 minutes. It doesn't require the employee to take the 15 minutes. Same is true with the mandatory meal break, so I think you're okay on both fronts there.
He's so smart. Representative Eastman, and then I think there's some people I want to talk against and for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You evidently had complaints about this. I guess I have never had a constituent call me with a complaint about this. And I would just like to point out is the break we're talking about here is not a coffee break or anything else. It's a restroom break. There is absolutely no benefit to an employee to not allow the restroom an employer to not allow the rest of their employees to go to the restroom.
We may hear testimony to that.
That has to be the exception. And I guess my question is do we take how prevalent is this issue, and do we take every issue where there may be an abuse or two or something and have to codify something in law that is going to take a lot of the flexibility that employees and employers have in their individual businesses and impact that? I've never heard of anybody that couldn't go to the bathroom if they needed to go to the bathroom as an employer. I have some employees. I wouldn't fall into this at this point because we don't have that enough. But I have employees that ask me if they can eat at their desk, and I tell them no. I said, get out of here for half an hour. You're a more valuable employee if you get out of here. I just think a lot of this stuff is stuff that employers and employees are dealing with now. And to put something in statute that, becomes rigid just doesn't seem to me to be going the right direction. Unless there's a huge, huge problem here. And I just can't see that there is.
We'll listen. Okay. And you're a kind man, Representative Easton. You want your employees to be happy. And I can see that in you, But not everybody's like you. Representative Haas. Were you raising your hand to go to the bathroom?
In another 4 hours.
Okay. Who wants to? Is anybody to talk for it or against it? We'll get the pro and cons up together. Welcome to the committees, gentlemen. Bernie, who wants to go first?
Doesn't matter to me.
I'll go first.
Go ahead.
I'm Bernie Hassam with the Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 789. Chair Ruccovino, we support this bill. And I'll just give you real briefly. We support 2810. Thanks for bringing this forward. It's a good bill, and it's for health reasons. It's a matter of health, and we have seen a problem in this, and I'll just mention the last three organizing drives that I've been involved in meatpacking. Two were beef, one was poultry. It was so dramatic in one plant that the restroom was actually locked. Okay. It's not uncommon in some of these plants for workers to void in the troughs because they can't get off the line. We have been successful in organizing these plants, and now we have language in our contract that provides for a relief worker. So when somebody has to use the facilities, they signal and they're relieved. But it's quite common in a number of industries where there's plant production that workers, that's their biggest complaint when you initially start your meetings with them and talk about issues on why they'd want to organize. So we think it's a health issue, we think it's a dignity issue, and this bill would help level the playing field for all these packing plants in Minnesota.
Questions?
I can stand for questions.
Oh, Mr. Hess. Okay. Representative Deppner, do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we're talking about union plants?
Mr. Chair, Representative Deppner, we're talking about plants that we've had organizing drives at. Some plants we were successful and we organized, and during our contract negotiations we were able to have a procedure for folks to use the facilities. In plants we weren't successful, I think that still is an issue.
Mr. Chair, when you say plants that were not successful in what? In this type of language? Or
chair, representative, no, in plants that we weren't able to organize a union at.
Okay. Okay. Now, plants, Mr. Chair, and testifier, plants that we have unions that are organized, there's no problem then?
Well, Mr. Representative Detmer, if you look at the language that's always been on the books, and I think this law was passed in my first or second year here, because I think I remember Representative Trimble carrying this bill in the first place.
I believe so.
I'm looking at Mr. Lefto, who used to be the committee administrator. Carruthers, okay, but it was then, right when I had come in. Before then, Representative Detmer, there were no laws at all as to allowing someone to go to the bathroom or take a break. Then this was put in, and it still is a problem. But if you look, there has always been a collective bargaining agreement in the law since it got passed in the mid-'80s or late-'80s that a union contract will determine, you know, what type of break there will be negotiated. So that's what Mr. Hess is referring to. Representative Eastland.
Based on this language, let's say you were a small business. I'm thinking of a number of them in Cambridge, people that I know, who, I mean, they don't restrict their employees from going to the bathroom or using the, but I mean, does there have to be a policy then in their handbook that says to everybody you have the right to at least to take at least 15 minutes from work to for bathroom breaks every 4 hours, or I mean, can they continue to operate as they are? I mean, they're not restricting them. If they have to go and if they happen to be sick, that they need to spend more than 15 minutes, they'll spend more than 15 minutes. But I guess what I'm seeing here is a real restrictive number that says this needs to be provided, and if it gets to be kind of a you know, rights issue that people, it seems to me that it's kind of counterproductive to just an agreement that people can do this, or they have the right to, there's no restrictions on them. I mean, if they needed more than 15, they could go more than 15, but I guess I don't understand why the 15? That's a long period of time. I don't think you need that long to relieve yourself.
Well, and I didn't initially, you know, I had a much simpler bill, but I did have the 15 and 30 minutes in there because that's typically what's allowed, you know, in many of the places I've worked. You got a 15-minute lunch break, you get a 15 minutes coffee, bathroom break, and then.
Isn't that usually a contractual agreement? Well, then that's where that 15 and 30 come from.
And it may be because I've worked in a lot of union places, but I come from the range. So, but you know, the whole issue again got back to the fact that I had been called, and I think another legislator had been called, and we went to Mr. Rakowski and asked him, and I had Ms. Newman check, and there basically was no actual way to enforce it. So that's what this is attempting to do, and you know. I'm going to let this bill get out of here on its own if it goes passes today, and try to work on it with the chamber. But you've heard the experiences we're hearing in some places, and I know of different ones that I don't want to, you know, sit here and talk about and belabor the issue. But I think it is it's kind of a dignity thing, and I don't think any one of us at this table would argue that people shouldn't be allowed to go to the bathroom while they're working.
I'm not arguing.
But there are situations where it's happening.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I guess I'm not understanding why current law doesn't cover the circumstances that are brought to our attention. That an employer must allow an employee. I mean, if they're relieving themselves inappropriately, I mean, clearly there's some violation of the current law. That's one of the things I don't understand. What we're hearing is already not appropriate according to the law.
We'll use a supporter of the bill to tell us what the experience is. Did you go to the Department of Labor and Industry? Do these people go to the Department of Labor and Industry? And is there an investigation or whatever? I know. Go ahead. But here, let me just say before he answers, the investigative part of the Department of Labor and Industry is the only place where there's general fund money. And if you look, that's the place where we keep cutting and cutting and cutting.
So the rest of it is basically funded on workers' comp overcharges on you small business people. All of you small business owners, which I didn't do, that's being done currently. So what we've seen is all of the things dealing with minimum wage, child labor laws, prevailing wage laws, that's the general fund funding that, and they have been cut, and there's nobody to investigate. But you give us your experience.
Chair Rakovina, Representative Eastland, our experience was we initially filed or contacted the USDA, who has inspectors in the plants. They said that wasn't their concern. Theirs was the supervising the slaughter and processing of animals. We were rebuffed. This is quite a while ago from the Department of Labor and Industry, because we didn't have a collective bargaining agreement in that plant at the time, so we didn't have any standing to initiate a complaint.
I appreciate that response, but I guess what I'm hearing is that if a union doesn't have a collective bargaining agreement, obviously they don't have standing for a complaint, but any employee does. Any employee could have gone to the Department of Labor and Industry and filed a complaint. They would have had standing, and it would have resulted in probably some kind of an investigation. I guess that's kind of my question here.
Chair Rakovina, Representative Eastland, a lot of these workers are newly arrived or immigrant workers. They're not always sure of their rights, and often they are very frightened to initiate an action.
Welcome to the committee. Just identify yourself.
Yeah. You bet, Mr. Chair. Jeremy Estenson, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. A lot of the points that I was going to cover have been gone over by Representative Eastland and Anderson, but first, we certainly sympathize with employees who are being mistreated at the hand of a bad employer. There's no doubt bad employers exist. We don't think there's many, though, and there's no doubt bad employees exist. And changing this language could cut probably both ways. First, on the flexibility things, it sounds like there may be some resolution as to whether or not employees would be required or if it would be permissive. It sounds like there's some resolution there. But the flexibility in the rigid 15 and 30 minutes might provide some unexpected consequences that we can't possibly think of right here. And I think the amendment that you tacked on sort of acknowledges that this language doesn't work for every situation. In fact, just a couple of other examples that I got from some of our members was for those folks who operate longer shifts but shorter weeks, so maybe 4-10s or something like that, this language would require, it appears anyways, a second 30-hour lunch break, and I can't imagine any employee who'd want to take a second 30-hour or 30-minute unpaid break in their shift sometime. And Bob Krogman's example of attending a cash register, certain retail situations, there could potentially be a skilled labor situation, a non-union skilled labor repairing. The example I got was repairing power lines after a storm. You might end up in a situation where you weren't able, for whatever reason, during a 4 or 5 hour period, just be able to get away. And so we're just worried that there are situations out there that this might create a problem for. But, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your opportunity to continue to work on the language.
Okay, and Ms. Representative Eastland, as a compromise here, perhaps I could move that the at least on line 1.6 become up to.
Well, I just talked to Mr. Herbie.
No, I didn't. But we think alike. It's frightening how I'm starting to think like you and vice versa. So Representative Eastland then moves up to delete at least and put up to. Is that fine?
Yeah, that helps.
On line 1.6, all accept it as a friendly amendment.
And can I have one other question?
You go ahead.
Is there a way that we could also place a more urgent requirement on Dolly to respond to complaints by employees for violations of this policy so that it isn't their decision not to respond? I don't know.
Mr. Rakowski, do you want to get involved in this bill? No?
No, I'll be... That's a good question, Representative Eastland and Mr.
Identify Jim. Yourself.
I'm John Rakowski with the Department of Labor and Industry, and that's a very good question. It came up in the Senate budget hearing as Representative Rukavina said, this is the only function at our department that is funded by the general fund. And they asked about backlog. So I've gotten constituents call their legislators, and then they contact us. Gee, I've had a simple dispute over, you know, overtime last October. How come you guys haven't gotten to me yet? And what I've found out is the only way to do this fairly is, for lack of a better term, we take the complaints and the investigations on a first-come, first-served basis. Otherwise, people will be calling the commissioner to get special treatment all the time. So that's how we practice that.
What are you looking at me for?
Not you. I'm just returning the feedback. So that's my answer, sir. I appreciate as Mr. Hess says, I suspect a lot of these folks don't even know what the Department of Labor and Industry is or how to go about making a complaint.
Representative Eastland, I think, as I said, I don't think anyone sitting here disagrees with the intent of the bill. We tried to make it now a little bit better. Is there anybody else that wants to testify for or against it? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one other issue that I wanted to bring up to you. And my husband's a teacher, and he gets 20 minutes for his lunch break. And so I'm wondering if this would impact school districts that have already negotiated that they get 20 minutes. And then will schools then also be required to provide 15 minutes in the morning and 15 minutes in the afternoon for their school teachers that work 8-hour days? And how does that play with, you know, they're on block scheduling? This is how it works out in order to manage the lunch flow in the school facility. They wouldn't be able to do it any other way. This is kind of how it does, how it works out for them. So how much, what kind of impact? Now, I saw you had some language on here that doesn't affect collective bargaining agreement, but that's assuming that they already get a 30-minute lunch break. So can you describe to me a little bit more about that?
No, exactly? Representative Anderson, in the example you gave with your husband, I'm sure if he's public school teacher anyway, he probably has a collective bargaining agreement, and okay, they probably have negotiated that. And I've always felt, you know, that teachers really work hard. They're very important members of society. You'll never hear me ever say anything bad about any teachers, because they've got, I think, one of the toughest jobs there is. And I've often wondered, you know, I remember saying once when I first got here that the janitor could use the telephone any time in the school, and the teacher can barely get enough time to call home if their kids are sick or whatever. And but I think that it's negotiated, and they're covered in both subdivisions with the collective bargaining agreement.
So, Mr. Chair, my question is: so does this mean that school districts are not required to abide by the 30-minute mealtime, and they're not required to abide by the up to 15 minutes every 4 hours that are worked? Is that correct?
If, Representative, if there's a collective bargaining agreement, no, they can negotiate whatever they want. And a lot of places negotiate a shorter lunch hour or whatever. So it would be a negotiable item. Representative Bryant.
That was just my point. I've negotiated a lot of contracts, and they're covered under this collective bargaining exemption.
Representative Eastland. Go ahead, Representative Anderson.
Well, I guess that begs the question of, you know, why are we then treating them differently than we are, you know, every other employee? I'll just leave that.
There's many, many parts of labor law that exempt, that have this type of language that, you know, we're not going to override a collective bargaining agreement. But I may be doing that later on this week. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm thinking of one specific company that I'm familiar with. My wife works there, where the policy is they have 20 minutes for their lunch break. And I believe it's paid. Now, what this one says is you have to give up to 30 minutes and you don't have to pay them. That's what I'm concerned about. We've got things that are working in private businesses all over the place where nobody is complaining about these issues that this is going to have a direct impact on what they do and how they function. That's what concerns me.
Well, and Representative Eastland, you know, we can look at the 30 even for that matter, but, you know, right now there is nothing that really allows people to enforce the law, I don't think. And there's no general fund dollars to help them enforce the law. And there are situations where it's not, you know, the letter of the law, the intent of the law isn't being upheld, and there's nobody there to enforce it. So
could I just
we fall back to, is there anybody at the table that actually thinks people shouldn't get the time to relieve themselves or have a lunch break? No, none of us.
I guess I don't know what other people are thinking, but I heard Representative Anderson just say that in her husband's contract, they get a 20-minute lunch break. In where my wife works, they get a 20-minute lunch break. I mean, is 30 minutes a magical number? Or I think probably anything under 20 minutes probably is not an adequate lunch break. I mean, that would be my feeling. But I mean, it seems like there's places out there that's kind of the standard that they're using at this point. So I don't know. It's maybe that number could be 20, and then that would be a little more reasonable from my standpoint. For people that already have long-standing practice that they've been doing that works for years.
Representative Eastland, you know, if I, you know, give in to you a second time this evening, will you stand with me and hug me on the House floor as we debate this bill?
You'll have to stand in a chair. So.
I will do that as long as you're hugging me while I'm standing there. Let's talk about it, and let's look at it, and I'm open to it because my intent with this, again, is to just have some dignity in the workplace. And, you know, you're right, 99% probably, or 95% at least, of employers are good employers that aren't abusers. But there are places that are, and I've been getting calls, and other folks have gotten calls, and Mr. Rakowski has alluded to the fact that they've gotten calls. So we'll talk about it and work on it and try to fix it up, because I'm even a little concerned yet about the numbers I put in here as far as the five employees to try to address some of the concerns of the smaller businesses. So, again, willing to try to fix it up, but none of us disagree with the intent of it, what we're trying to do here. So, no further questions, and I'll move that. Also, 2810 is amended, be recommended to pass, and I think it could go right to the floor, too. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Who's against bathroom breaks? Motion prevails. Representative Kalin, 2946. Oh, Representative Dabney.
Yes.
Excuse me. Representative Dabney.
Oh,
sorry.
Quite all right.
Don't you make my brown eyes blue.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to assure you that Representative Anderson's husband's needs were met by the collective bargaining agreement in that district when I was the union president in that district.
So you say you gave him the shaft?
I don't think
you
I'm
couldn't get 30
that.
Minutes. What's the matter with you? Let's kill his bill, members.
There you go. I think the decision by the high school staff to go to block scheduling has created some interesting scheduling challenges there.
Representative Haas moves House File 3127 be recommended to pass, and this is a money bill, right?
Well, it's only the unemployment insurance fund. It's not general fund dollars.
We recommend to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Otherwise, what would be what's behind door number two, Mr. Chair?
Well, you still have to go to finance one way or the other.
Okay. So,
this is something that Deed wants, right?
You know, I haven't actually had that conversation with them. This is the product of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, so it does have support from a broad range of stakeholders who I think would like to see several elements of it pass, yes.
Okay. Go ahead, present the bill.
All right. Mr. Chair, thank you, and members. This is the product of the UI Advisory Council. It does a number of things. One of the concerns is that the UI Trust Fund is in deficit and is going to continue in that way. There's a quirk in current law that would actually decrease the tax rate even though the fund is in deficit. This resolves that and assures that the funds will continue to flow into the trust fund. It makes a new business tax rate for employers and for new employers in high experience rating industries that's more fair for them and their competitors in that industry. Provides a discount. This is a win-win discount for employers who prepay their unemployment taxes. They get a discount, so it's an advantage to the business for prepaying. The trust fund gets money early, so it's an advantage to the trust fund in terms of long-term trying to resolve the deficit. Provides both government and nonprofits with greater flexibility as to when they change the method of paying unemployment insurance costs, and modifies and simplifies the business owner and family member statute to prevent abuse of seasonal layoffs in that area. In addition, it deals with extension of the additional 13 weeks of benefits for workers in the special emergency funds due to the ongoing recession and high unemployment rate. With me today, if members have technical questions, is Mr. Nelson from the department.
Yeah, Mr. Nelson, do you want to just come up and some brief comments on the bill? And Mr. Nelson, was there some memos sent out to businesses recently about unemployment insurance tax?
No, I didn't have one like this.
Being recaptured or assessed, reassessed or something? Before we get on with this bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, you're correct. We compute rates to 125,000. There was a slight glitch, and I'm not sure, but it was less than 1,000 were improperly assessed. Some were, in fact, assessed too high a rate, and they were all provided refunds. And some businesses underpaid their 2009 tax, and they were told, here's what you should have paid, and here's what you're required to then pay, no interest, no penalties, but making businesses pay what they should have paid had it been properly computed. So that was a relatively small number of employers that applied to.
So there were no interest or penalties at all applied?
No interest or penalties.
And what time of a grace period to pay that back? Was there a grace period given?
I don't know, but we'll certainly work with any business who has any problem paying any tax. So okay. We're very lenient, quite frankly, on waiving any interest and penalties. We want to get the taxes paid, and we don't want to pose any undue burden on employers. We're having a tough time right now.
And so I'm assuming that this bill, Mr. Nelson, Representative Dabney, you said it has the support of everybody that sits on the UI work council, and
still opposition.
That's correct.
And Representative Overmuller, you know, sometimes we get things even that have been reviewed by both labor and business on the UI council, and those changes make things a little more difficult for people to get unemployment insurance. And is there anything in this bill that would be affecting that and making a higher bar for people that have gotten laid off to get insurance, unemployment insurance?
Mr. Chairman, members, actually the only thing in here which impacts workers actually provides, it's fairly technical, when they're filing a second, what's called a second benefit account, current law provides for no limitation when the special requirements are. This bill, in fact, puts a 52-week limitation. So there are enhanced requirements if you're filing a second account. The current law says a second account can be 10 years later. This limits that to a 52-week period. So there are not special requirements if you're filing a second account after the 52-week period. Then you meet the general requirements. But other than that, there is a little provision dealing with business owners. But that's to an attempt to streamline the law and eliminate some of the inequities.
And the 13-week extension in the bill, what's the estimated cost on that?
Mr. Chairman, members, there are two parts to that, if I might explain. Directly to your question, Mr. Chairman, $13 million. Mr. Chairman, this bill currently provides that if an individual is before June 30th is on the current, what we call backfill extension, they would stay on that. But people who, after June 30th, qualify for an extension, they would have to go on the new extension provided in this bill, which would be limited to currently to 13 weeks, but it is mirrored to the extended benefit program. So if the extended benefit program automatically expands to 20 weeks, which it did for a while, people under this bill would get that automatic increase. But it is, this current extension is tied to the extended benefit program, which is in state law. It is not tied to the federal program.
So does this then mirror the extension that Representative Mahoney did last year? That was just the state extension? Is that an extension on that extension, basically?
Mr. Chairman, no, it's a little bit different. That was tied to the federal law. And part of the problem was federal law, they kept expanding that and drove the costs up twice as high as originally been predicted. This will put the cost back into what had been predicted and ties it to the state extension, which is in place, which is currently 13 weeks, but has been expanded and can expand up to 20 weeks. But this brings the costs into the original estimate. At the time Representative Mahoney's bill had passed, the federal extension was only 13 weeks, but now Congress has expanded that substantially. And this brings it back down to its original cost.
Okay. Representative Obermueller, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if it's Representative Dabney or Mr. Nelson, but first the question that comes to mind is high rate industry. Pulled my bill here and I lost it. But the high rating experience industries. Can you tell me how that is defined in statute? What that who fits into that category?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Obermueller, high experience rating industry is defined in the statute. Essentially, it's construction and gravel pits and other cement companies dealing with heavy construction. And what this bill does is provide that they have a floating rate. They will get the average for that high experience rating industry, those group of employers, whatever that average would be, up to the current maximum. So if ultimately the average fell, they would go down. Current law has a fixed rate. And so this one, they get nothing special. A new employer who comes in to build a bridge in Minnesota gets no better rate than the average rate for them, construction companies in Minnesota. They get the same as the average would be.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just on that point, though, but wasn't the, under the old law, the high experience rating, was it lower or higher than the one that was being paid by a normal employer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Obermueller, an individual employer will get whatever their computed would be, and that may be the maximum, which is currently 8.9%, or it may be substantially lower. Many construction companies, let's deal in residential construction, are well below the maximum. It's whatever they happen to earn. And many of the heavy construction, road building, are at the current maximum. But current law provides for just a special fixed rate, and this says they get a floating rate. So they would get the average of their competitors when they go into business, whatever that average would be, whether it be lower or higher.
All right, Mr. Chair, if I may just follow up on that. I guess the concern I have is that for those that are fortunate enough to be small and they aren't having the layoffs, they're not at their maximums, this might actually significantly raise theirs because they're going to come up to the average, or am I missing the boat on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Obermueller, no, this is only for a new business just starting in that industry. An employer who has earned the rate keeps their rate, whatever it may be. They're not impacted by this.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, one other topic, if I could, just on the issue of the 13-week extension. Under current law, we've tied it to our state extended benefit, if I'm not mistaken. So this actually could shorten up the time period that people are if the feds don't extend their extended benefit program. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, this will unhinge it from the federal extension. The current extension, which does in fact expire on June 30th under current law, is tied to the federal. It mirrors the federal. This is a new extension, and it no longer mirrors the federal, but mirrors the special state extension found in 268.115. And yes, it would be less than current than the current federal extension. A concern was the cost of the prior bill. The actual cost came in twice as high as had originally been predicted, because it's at the control of the federal government, whatever they happen to make that extension. And this unhinges it from the federal and ties it in. Minnesota is only one of three states which provides this backfill extension. Most states, Wisconsin, all our neighbors, do not provide this type of backfill extension. Minnesota is one of three states which do it. And a concern was the cost of the prior program.
And, Mr. Nelson, one last question for me. This extension will in no way then cause that problem that we were seeing where, because this is the extension, again, is just conceptually for somebody that doesn't qualify for the federal program, or will it cause that problem that we are trying to correct with Representative Obermueller's bill, where they have to jump back on the state in unemployment insurance and then they get a lower weekly benefit?
Mr. Chairman, in response to your question, it would be possible. It would be possible absent House File 3274 that an individual could start on this extension, then qualify for regular benefits at a lower amount. They would have to then go on regular benefits at a lower amount. This does not deal with that glitch. It just absolutely mirrors the current state extension, which is true for everyone else. It doesn't have any special provisions. But if 3274 passes, it will
correct this.
Okay. Yes.
All right, Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How long does it take to earn your rate? I mean, if we're talking about earning your rate,
Mr. Nelson,
I know if you have claims, it goes up and it takes 4 years to get rid of them. But how long does it take to earn your rate?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland. An employer has to be in business for 12 consecutive months, but starting on July 1st. So if they started business on July 1st, they would have earned it by June 30th of the following year. Then for the following calendar year, they would get their own rate. I don't know how to explain that right. But you have to be in business for 12 months of a fiscal year. And then you get it the following year. I don't know if I explained that right. It's almost easier by a chart.
That's good enough. But I don't need a long explanation. But it's a relatively short period of time. That's all I'm saying. It's not like a tenure. The other question I have is just with this new with this bill, what's the net impact to be our unemployment fund? What is the net impact going to be when this is implemented?
Mr. Nelson, on top of the $13 million you cited, what other costs are there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it doesn't cost anything. We believe, as Representative Dabney explained, one particular provision provides a tax discount if employers pay their unemployment taxes early. We're talking about early by 4 years. They, in effect, prepay their taxes by 4 years. They get a discount. We don't know how much employers will take advantage of that. That's one of the reasons we've asked for a 3-year sunset on it. It could actually help the fund. The fund wouldn't then have to borrow as much and pay interest on federal loans. How much that would actually work out to be, I can't really give you an estimate. We don't know. But that's the only other thing which will impact the fund from a dollar perspective.
Okay. No further questions, and thank you, Representative Dabney, and we'll
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah.
And Representative Kalin, 2946. Representative Mahoney moves that that House File 2946 be recommended, passed, and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Kalin, welcome to the committee. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have one small amendment, the A1 amendment that Paige asked for you. It's a technical amendment. I can explain it after it's been handed out.
Representative Mahoney then offers the
I haven't seen it yet, but I'll offer it, Mr. Chair.
It'd be the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2946 is a fairly straightforward policy.
No, this isn't the
change.
One.
That's not my A1 amendment is four lines. so.
No.
Stop. Don't stand this up.
We need the A1 amendment to 2946. Okay. Unless you want to put barber fees on this, go ahead. I think this
perhaps if that's what it takes to pass the bill, then I'll consider it. But it's 2946 is actually not a barber fee bill, but policy change to the one of the business development public infrastructure grant programs that we have in the state. The clean energy economy is actually quite robust out in Minnesota. I know that the chair has a has an interesting solar assembly and manufacturing company that he's interested in. I know that VECO in Representative McFarland's district to Electrolux freezers in St. Cloud, Representative Hawes's district or nearby, is actually the world's largest manufacturer of Energy Star rated freezers in the world. Pretty amazing. It is in your district. And so what this bill would do is just expand the eligibility for what is, in essence, our innovative infrastructure grant program to include clean energy. There was a question in the division, in Representative Mahoney's division, raised by Representative Norton, who's not able to be with us, about the eligibility of waste-to-energy facilities. And that's what the A1 amendment will do, is to make sure that waste-to-energy facilities like that contemplated in Rochester and around the state would be eligible for this program. And I think that it's a reasonable accommodation. So I ask members for their support on the A1 amendment.
Representative Mahoney, any further discussion on the A1 amendment?
I think the A1 amendment is fine, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark and then Anderson.
Yes, Representative Kalin, does this impact the project that's going forward in Hennepin County?
Representative Kalin.
How does it impact?
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, is the project is it in Minneapolis or in Hennepin County? In Minneapolis, is it publicly owned or is it privately being developed? I thought it was publicly owned.
Owned by Hennepin County.
Then, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I believe that these grants are restricted to grants to private businesses. They can be used for publicly owned project. Representative Mahoney is correcting me. So it actually would make it eligible. I will point out to the committee that that it's currently a fairly competitive grant program. The funds are at zero unless we can pass a bonding bill and replenish that program, which is of great urgency.
Representative Mahoney, I can't remember, was it a $10 million or $7 million in the bonding bill for replacing that fund that we're talking about right here?
Mr. Chair, I think it was just over $5 million that replaced the bioinfrastructure grant program. And then there was $19 million for rural economic development, and there was none for the metro area.
Well, I don't know. There isn't more than enough for. But what I'm asking then is the expansion of this going to obviously deplete the fund quicker, but you're supportive of this since I believe you had a lot to do with a lot of this.
Mr. Chair, as was testified in my committee, we could put $50 million into this and go through it within the first 6 months of the year. Into this bio grants. So Minneapolis never does anything small, so I don't know that if they applied, they probably would only get about a quarter of what they would apply for with this grant. So yes, if it makes them possible, then I'm fine with that. What we'd like to do is make this basically a proprietary technology type infrastructure grant, so it would expand it greatly. We need to do that.
And so the amendment then, and the amendment, just so I understand it, 116J.437, Representative Kalin, must not recover then energy recovery facilities that use garbage and burn garbage, so you're making the exemption at this one.
Correct, Mr. Chair. Just a tiny little bit of background. That the 116J.437 green economy definition references five energy and environmental standards we passed with 90% votes in this body and signed by Governor Pawlenty in the last 4 or 5 years. One of them is the renewable electricity standard, and it's that definition that excluded the language here, and I believe that we will probably have to continue to work with Chair Hilty and Representative Hornstein, who have raised this issue about eligible technologies. I believe that I'm putting a stake in the ground to say that I think we should continue to support it through the infrastructure grant programs, and we'll continue to have that debate at a, you know, the larger policy debate. But I think that you know, the less going into landfills and more going into generation is probably a good idea, though we should be doing less consumption and more recycling and, you know, less impact across the board.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not trying to include Hennepin County in this. I'd like to exclude Hennepin County from this. It's a very controversial proposal in Hennepin County to increase the garbage burning capacity of the Hennepin County burner. And if this blesses it with a green economy label on it, I'd oppose it. So unless you're willing to exclude it, I think a problem.
Mr. Chair, I think this is exactly the tension on this issue. I think that it does create jobs, and I very much understand the position and the folks who oppose, like Representative Clark, who oppose burning garbage. I think that there's certainly valid considerations there. I do think that it's a technology that we should continue to think about supporting, and members can vote how they want to vote on the amendment.
We're still on the amendment.
Representative, go ahead. It wouldn't be accurate to say I totally oppose burning garbage, but in the middle of a city right next to a brand new stadium, there could be a lot more conservation going on, as we discussed even in a different bill yesterday. The efforts to do conservation rather than just burning garbage is what this is about for me. And it's very controversial, as you know. The environmentalists in Minneapolis and Hennepin County are not in support of this sort of thing. So I just want to say that I would be happy to have it be excluded as a way to handle that concern.
Representative Anderson. To this, are you to the amendment?
I got my question answered.
Okay, thanks. Representative Haas.
This is a very controversial item, and you're damned if you do it, damned if you don't. You know, turkey poop and fiber lot gets to be recycled. And one time I designed a garbage truck as a large turkey, and then we can put it in the dump in the front and take it out the back and claim it was poop and make it recyclable. But this is a controversial issue, and as soon as you put it in, the other side is going to attack you. You take it out, the other side is going to attack you. So good luck with your amendment.
Representative Reiner, thank you for that advice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kahle. My thoughts are much along the lines that have been expressed. I sat in after the meeting in Representative Mahoney's committee on the discussion between Representative Hilty and Representative Norton, and I'm inclined to support Representative Hilty's perspective on this. I think it's a very complicated case to call garbage burning a green part of the green economy, recognizing that there's that was the intent when some of our plans were originated, but we know a lot more about emissions than we knew then, and we have other alternatives in recycling and you know, other biogas and so forth. So I'm very conflicted about this, and I'm wondering, what is your position on this? Do you really want this included, or are you pragmatically trying to just buy out this situation? I'm trying to put you on the spot, Jeremy. I am, but I'm really concerned about the definition of green.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Breinert. We are not changing the actual definition of green economy in 116J, and we're not changing the definition of renewable electricity standard in 216B, because I I believe that for the purposes of this grant, that these projects should be eligible, because really this project, this grant program is about putting people to work and doing the infrastructure, the pipes and pavement. Its eligibility under the broader definitions, I think, should we continue to discuss. So I hope that it's the most conservative approach to stepping in the muck, almost literally, that Representative Hawes explained.
Representative Clark, are you done then?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I would propose an amendment then if the author of the bill doesn't...
To this point, Mr. Chair?
Representative...
To this point? Representative Clark, the motion is to lay this over, and we will have to put together an omnibus bill. I don't disagree if that's what you choose to do, but making laws on the fly always tends to get us in trouble. And I'm comfortable, and it sounded like Representative Kalin was reasonably comfortable with that, with you putting that amendment in at this particular time to exclude Minneapolis, if that's what you choose to do. But I just don't think we should probably make this kind of a law on the fly. I mean, if it's an omnibus bill, we can put the amendment in at tomorrow when we put it together, or Thursday when we put the omnibus bill together.
I guess I'd like to hear from the author of the amendment. I don't consider this amendment any more on the fly than the amendment that's being proposed, but anyway, what is your response to the
Representative? Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, this language is actually lifted directly from what's excluded in 216B.1691, the renewable electricity standard. So, that said, I mean, if your intention is to exclude a project in your district, I think that we can certainly... I have no problem with people excluding eligibility for this grant program, because there's certainly plenty of interest, as you see in the letters that I think you got, that you received
so
as well.
In the renewable energy language, this language is exactly the same to exclude them from being renewable energy, but as far as green economy and clean energy for business development purposes, it's included.
Yes, and I, there's the rub.
Okay.
So,
just so we understand, Representative.
So are you saying, Representative Kalin, that you're willing to work with me on changing this?
If, Mr. Chair, if you're talking about excluding Representative Clark, excluding the Minneapolis project,
the Hennepin County,
sure,
garbage burner.
Yeah, but the facility in downtown Minneapolis next to the Twin Stadium, I'm sure. I mean, that's okay, all the more chances for
projects. Well, as Representative Mahoney said, this will be held over for possible inclusion, and it can be worked on between you two. Representative Eastland.
I think my questions might have been answered, but we're talking about the Minneapolis garbage printer. Who owns and operates that?
It's actually a Hennepin County facility. Hennepin County
operates it as well?
Hennepin County, yes.
I guess what I'm struggling with here is that we're extending the whole public infrastructure piece to being in business, for public entities actually running the business as well. And I guess it would seem to me that's really putting it farther out than the intent of this original legislation, which was for the public sector to be involved providing the infrastructure, for the private industry to come in and create the tax base that we need to really generate the revenue. And so I see this as going a direction that's really contrary to where I think the original bill went. And I that's where I'm struggling.
And Mr. Chair, to that point, Representative Eastland, that's where I am too. And it was actually news to me that this grant program can be spent on public projects. And maybe one of the things that this committee wants to talk more openly, because of the demand for these projects, I was thinking of projects like Evercat Fuels in Isanti, the carbon neutral industrial park we're developing in the Chisago Lakes area, et cetera, where they're privately owned, and that's really the pipes and pavement to help support private business.
And you bring up a very good point, Tom. Mm-hmm. Representative Mahoney, your good point.
I actually think that this has gone, there's a misconception here. This is an infrastructure grant program. Infrastructure grants cover sewer, water, roads. It was used for a stop-and-go light out in Chaska. We are not building a garbage burner. You're not doing the pipes within a garbage burner. You're not doing the boiler or the burners. You are laying out sewer, water, asphalt, maybe a stoplight so a truck could get in and get out easier. And frankly, you know, this is a truck getting in and out of a bioscience building out at St. Jude's. We're going to use some of this money for an off-ramp, I think it is, off a bridge over 36 at Rice Street. So we're not building or running or anything like that, power plants or garbage burners or anything like that. This is all the sewer water infrastructure that's needed for an entity to come in and put one up. So I hope I made that relatively clear. I'm not running a business.
If you recall, we had the discussion in the, I think we had a bill in the Capitol when we had the two hearings on capital bonding projects, and there was that exact point on the St. Jude or whatever that was left over from one of these grants, I think, that we allowed them to use it, reuse it for another part of the road construction there.
Yeah, and I appreciate the and I guess I'm just looking at this amendment, and it's it seems like it clouds up the water a little bit, and that's all I'm saying.
I think Representative Clark would agree with you there.
No pun intended. Representative Haas.
Yes, I have a question for Representative Mahoney. Do you have any concern that adding this green economy in here is going to, of course, we have no money in the grant, so what the hell, we're going to share zero anyway. But do you have any problem with a green economy coming in here and squeezing out bioscience infrastructure or facilities created for bioscience?
Representative Mahoney.
No, I don't. Particular time.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Have you had any complaints from any bioscience agencies or organizations or businesses that they may be getting squeezed out of this grant?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mahoney.
Representative Posse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I think in the bioscience committee when we heard this, we did talk about the fact that this is limited funds, and we have used them for the biosciences. And I know in my community we have the Hormel Institute, which is a cancer research institute, that they did use money from this fund in order to be able to have the roadway realigned in the front of that building. And so it is something that I think is used throughout, thing that I think is used throughout the state and has been geared toward bioscience-related activity. And so, you know, the more we dilute it, the more we add things to it, you're only going to have so many funds, and those funds are going to have to be stretched over more projects, and there's going to be more ideas that are going to come forward. That may be good to try to spread it out over more things, but with the limited dollars, it's going to mean that some, I guess I would fear that there might be a potential that bioscience projects would be not supported if we add too many things to this grant.
Representative
Kalin. Mr. Chair, I appreciate Representative Poppy's concern. I would just point to the letter from the Biobusiness Alliance, February 26th, the last paragraph. Imperative for the future of our state's economy, we continue to develop public policy to and support infrastructure to help create, retain, recruit, and expand companies in Minnesota. And this is in the context of 70 Minnesota-based companies in the renewable energy industry that they've got in their online bioscience tracking tool. So, you know, it's a I know this committee and Chair Mahoney have done a lot of really good work with the Biobusiness Alliance, and I think that moving forward is a prudent step with 2946, the bill before you, and I think that we will see that we're continuing to have the job growth and the capital expansion that we need. And I will continue to monitor this very closely because I do share that concern. I'd like to see $200 million going into infrastructure this year because we need it, and we can use it.
As Representative Haas said, it's kind of a moot point right now because we don't even know what kind of money we're talking about here. I think in the bond bill, as I recall, there was maybe Ms. Batsley remembers or someone in the room, I think it ended up being about $7 million, I thought. But
I was thinking it was $5 million.
Okay. So we're diluting $5 million by a little. I don't believe we ever voted on the amendment, so all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Oh. Motion prevails.
Division.
Okay. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, raise your hand. All those opposed? Motion does not prevail. Okay, and we have the bill before us, not as amended. All those, well, we're just holding over class inclusion. Thank you, Representative Kayla, and Representative Mahoney and Representative Clark. Hopefully you can work on this concept as we...
Well, I think the issue may be moved, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
No. Not that it's still being held over for possible amendment.
Turkey truck design, you can get it through.
No, the amendment didn't come. No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Yes. Representative Clark, do you want? Should we take Representative Loeffler first? Is she here? Okay, Representative Clark moves House File 3517. You recommend it to pass, and that'll be in our omnibus bill dealing with fees. And Representative Clark, we need an amendment. Is this the amendment?
I think we got about three amendments now.
We got three amendments to the bill. Representative Clark.
First one is the A2 amendment, I believe. That's the broader one.
Okay.
Yeah, A2 amendment.
A3?
Isn't
that A3? No. Representative Clark moves
A3.
The... No. We've got
probably
an A2.
A2. Yeah. We'll get to A3 later.
It's not hers.
I'm sorry.
Representative Clark moves the A3 amendment.
I'm sorry.
Representative Clark. First of all, Representative Clark moves House File 3517 being recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion. Representative Clark on the A3 amendment.
Mr. Chair, is that being handed out right now?
No, we don't have that.
I only have the A2.
I think it was handed out by mistake a few minutes ago.
We didn't finish.
Oh, okay. All right.
What the bill?
Bill in.
We don't have the A2.
The A3 is what we need. And the bill should have been in your packet.
The A2 is in our packet.
Can I get the A2?
The A2 is in the packet.
He's got the A3.
Okay.
I got the amendment right over there.
We need to pass it.
This turkey garbage truck.
This is the A5.
Representative Clark to the A3 amendment.
It's valuable.
Chairman, I understand, first of all, the major bill is trying to deal with some issues of staffing and so on at the agency and so on. But this particular amendment is simply cleaning up something that was left over when the barber's board and the cosmetology board was separated. So this makes clear that hair braiders, are... I thought it was moving them over to the cosmetology. That's what it's supposed to be doing.
Okay.
Yes, it does, yeah. And it says there's supposed to be a $20.
Everybody understand that? It was a mistake that I believe left them in the barber's. Okay. All those in favor then signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. That motion prevails. Representative Feiner, do you want to talk about the A2 amendment?
Well, Mr. Chair, do you want to do the A5? It's kind of a cleanup before we get it to the A2.
Okay, I'll move the A5 amendment, and it is a cleanup. And Mr. Berg, you want to explain the A5 amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, the A5 amendment is kind of technical in nature. What it does is, consulted with the chief fiscal analyst, Mr. Marks, who is suggesting that we do this, and I've talked to the finance department. It deletes on page 2 the words except for application fees and the creation of a dedicated account and the statutory appropriation in this bill. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is that the language does not make it clear whether this account is in the general fund or other fund. There has been an ongoing effort to get dedicated statutory expenditure accounts out of the general fund, and in fact, Representative Solberg is carrying a bill that is supposed to try to do that
once and for all. We could specify that it's in the special revenue fund, but since this board gets most of its funding, or gets 100% of its funding at this point from general fund appropriations, and the rest of its fees are deposited in the general fund, Mr. Marks and I talked about it and decided it needlessly complicates the funding stream for a small agency to have two separate funds go to them. And this would leave all the fees the same and the deposit into the general fund. And, Mr. Chair, I know you have talked about that our omnibus bill would simply do a general fund appropriation of the amount. There's a fiscal note request on this. And the amount that comes back that's raised in revenue, we would just, it's much cleaner to just appropriate that out of the general fund. Okay. And so that's a long explanation for saying that there's not going to be a dedicated account if you do this amendment.
Okay, so we have the A5 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Clark, explain the bill, and then Representative Reinert has his amendment. So,
Mr. Chairman, the bill does come out of some discussions that we had with the Board of Cosmetology following some concerns that were raised by constituents about service, and then also the cosmetology board, its concerns about not having inadequate staff to deliver the kind of service that is needed. So we go through and lay out a fee structure that will provide some additional staff, and describe some additional information about license expiration dates. They are going to now be changed so that the expiration will be on the licensee's birthday rather than at the end of the year. And this is something that the board thinks it can work with, and it will help make sure that we don't have huge backlogs at the end of the year for the agency, which has been part of the problem. And then I believe there's some rulemaking that is technical, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Reinert then moves the...
Actually, Mr. Chair, I'd prefer to wait on moving my amendment until we get to have some response from the board on some of the issues that Representative Clark knows about, I know about, and know Representative Gunther has heard them, and they're...
And myself. So.
Extremely slow responses, rude, just flat-out rude responses from staff to licensees that are trying to grow and expand small business in a down economy, so...
Welcome to the committee, and I just identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Gina Stouse, and I'm the executive director with the Board of Cosmetology.
Go ahead, on the bill.
Okay, as Representative Clark was stating, currently the way our board works is that all licenses are on a three-year cycle, and they all come due at the end of the year, the 12/31 of the year in which you expire. And what this bill would do would basically allow it to kind of flow over the 12 months of expiring on your birth date if you were an individual, or expiring on the month in which you were initially licensed if you were a salon. So this would, instead of like roughly 16,000 renewals becoming due by December 31st, it would hopefully spread them out pretty evenly during the year. Other boards, other health licensing boards, specifically Board of Dentistry, has recently done this, and it does. There is a transition time to learn the process. I mean, it would essentially be changing everything we do in our office on a daily basis, but once you get through the initial hiccup, I've been told that it is a very successful transition to do it this way, and you would be renewing all year long. That is the majority of the purpose of the bill, as well as creating an application fee in order to provide more staffing. When the Board of Cosmetology and Barbers originally merged, the committee was gracious enough to give the board's money to create a licensing system, and we did do that, but human beings need to be there to enter in the data and actually process the applications. The one thing about the Board of Cosmetology is that you don't just put a check in, their payment in, and they automatically get a license. There is a verification of credentials, both on the initial application as well on the renewals. It's not cited very clearly. It's more in rule on the renewals, which is roughly the 16,000. There's a requirement that people, when they renew, they're working in a licensed establishment, and that they work so many hours per year. And if they don't work in a licensed establishment, they take a what we call a refresher course. So when we get these renewals in, there is you know, fraud, and we have to attempt to catch that. I mean, we have our complaint committee is actually meeting next week, and we have a very significant number of licensees going to our complaint committee for fines, potential fines and civil penalties, because they're saying they're working in salons that don't exist. So it's not just entering a check, depositing it, and you get a license. So the increase of the fees would allow the board to get more human beings in the office to assist in licensing. For your information, we're housed with 18 other health boards, and we're considered a non-health board, but we have the second largest agency of all those 18 with over 36,000 licensees. We're right behind Board of Nursing, but in that group of agencies, we have the 10th smallest staff. So we are in desperate need of more staff in order to accomplish the goals to eliminate you know, the complaints you are getting. Last year we got 90,000 phone calls, and we have one person to answer the phone.
Okay. Representative Anderson and then Representative Easton.
You can go first, that's fine.
Representative Easton.
Yeah, I just have a question. I mean, sure. Obviously this barber cosmopolitan thing has been around for a while, and I remember when we put them together, and last year we took them apart.
Yep.
And I guess when we did this last year, I mean, wasn't this an issue at the time? Didn't we see this coming, that there was going to be issues with how they functioned? And one of the points of putting them together was to get some scale of economy and do some things that work together. I don't understand. I mean, I guess it just seems like we're constantly fixing this feud between these two organizations.
Representative Easton, the feud isn't between the barber board and the cosmetologist anymore. No, the feud is between legislators and the cosmetologist board. So,
Mr. Chairman, may I comment?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, what was your name again?
Gina.
Ms. Gina, can remind me again, how many staff do you have for the board?
Mr. Chairman, a member of the committees, including myself, we have 7.3 permanent employees.
Okay, and what is your current budget?
Currently, our base budget is $651. This fiscal year, we have a one-time appropriation, so we're at $691 for this current year, with with roughly 54% of our license fees staying in the general fund.
$651,000.
Yes.
Okay, and then how much in these fee increases? How much will that increase to?
Ms. Stones.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for individual licensees, the fees would be a variable. We're looking at approximately $250,000 for individual licensees and $130,000 for businesses.
So $250,000
and $130,000? Representative Anderson, maybe Mr. Burke can give us. Do you have a fiscal note coming?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, there is a fiscal note request that's active. It hasn't been finished yet, then I have to change it after the amendments. I guess when I was told unofficially when we got the bill that it would raise about 2.25 a year, but we haven't gotten a fiscal note back from MMB yet.
$225,000
was what I was told unofficially, but.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and when we were discussing it, it was the impact they asked on was individual licensees, so that was the amount on individual people, and the information I received is that business licensees were not to be a part of that initial $225,000. So again, it's a variable fee because we license on a 3-year cycle, and so some years it could go up and some years it could go down. Now, that was, I know he switched the way that the fee was going to work, not a non-special dedicated. When talking about it, that the reason we had done it that way was if we didn't collect enough, we would have to live with not collecting that amount, where if you give the direct appropriation, we get that regardless if we over-collect or under-collect, okay? And so that was the approach in the numbers, because it's a 3-year cycle, so if you take the increase and divide it by 3, it isn't as drastic, and the numbers are actually lower than initially asked for.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Just two quick more questions. Where is this going? Is this being...
It'll be in the
bill. Yeah. Okay. And then one other question for you, Mayor.
Sure.
Now, you said you have 36,000 licensees.
Correct.
How many of those, their licenses are up each year, since you said have a 3-year license? How many average that you see?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it's on average like 16,000. We have, you know, individuals who drop off every renewal season who choose not to renew. We have individuals who change license type, and so they are not renewing the current license type. And then people who just choose not to renew. So we do have a percentage of drop-offs every renewal season. An example, this year we sent out 12,715 renewals, and it changes every year.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Reiner, do you want to offer the...
Not yet, Mr. Chairman. I have a few questions, though.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Stelzman, when we talk about the fee increases, did you have input on those numbers? And if so, can you tell me a little bit about, what we just heard is that it will bring almost another 50% of your budget in. So I'm curious about the figures. I'd like to know exactly what staff that's going to equate to in your office. And actually, I'm sorry, Ms. Delsman, let me back up. Can you, first of all, you said you had
7.3
FTE. Can you tell us what those 7.3 people do?
Sure. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the 7.3, 5.3 of those are in-house, in the office people. That includes myself, a program manager who oversees the complaints and the inspectors and, like, does rulemaking. Of those 5.3, 2.3 of them do things such as licensing, complaints. They're the ones that do our primary processing of applications, and one of them is a receptionist answering the 90,000 phone calls, and then the other two of them are inspectors, so that adds to the total of 7.3.
And the inspectors are out in the field, they visit the salons and...
Yes, that's correct, they're out in the field pretty much 95% of the time.
How many phone calls do you answer, and how many applications do you process?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, well, when the staff were backed up, I just had a baby, so I've been out of the office since November. I'm just getting back in. I actually processed over 80 licenses myself. I don't have the main line ringing into my office, but I don't know. I could say on a daily basis, I probably get 10 to 15 phone calls to my line as the director a day. But I am one, I believe, if you're familiar with Richard Branson, he's the CEO of Virgin Airlines. He does anything that he's legally able to do in his company, and I believe that philosophy for myself. I will do anything when the need arises to do anything I'm legally able to do in my agency. But I do have an obligation to run the agency as well.
Sure. And yep. Mr. Chairman, I asked the question because when I had a shop that was looking to expand in the worst economy we've seen in decades, and couldn't get a license processed, and I, as a legislator, was trying to find out why I couldn't reach you. So that was a bit frustrating. So what staff would these additional revenues add specifically?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I did have the salary of typically the individuals we have currently in the office. We have the salary and fringe for one employee is like 51,000 roughly. For an intermediate level staff, it's 57,000 for salary and fringe. It depends on how many staff we would hire. If the funds stay as what I indicated earlier, we'd be looking at, you know, 5 new people. That may include some additional space. What the funding would go to, it's not going to go to anything other than people. I'm going to use the funding as up to the dollar I can to get more people. I'm not, what this funding would also do is absorb the licensing or the system cost it's going to take to change the licensing system. It's going to be about a $50,000 cost to change the licensing system, to change it from year end to birth dates. Okay, so this it's a one-time, it is a one-time cost. We have one-time cost to look at space and desks, because we are pretty much full in our agency. There's other agencies we can sublease from. There's definite possibility of all of that. But it's roughly, you know, $50,000 to $60,000 per employee with salary and fringe. And that doesn't include communications or...
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, Ms. Dawson. I'm curious what exactly you will have these five people do.
Oh,
I mean, if we're going to authorize increasing your budget by 50%, I want to have an idea of what they're going to do and how someone applying for a renewal or a license expansion next year is going to have a better experience than what several members on this committee have heard.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would love to be able with this money to take. Two additional people and make them receptionists. So instead of one person, we'd have a total of three. We would also get more phone lines because right now we only have two-part line coming in. The other individuals would do licensing. So I would likely change the way I have my staffing laid out, and we would hire, per se, two people to process only renewals. That would be their full-time job all year long. That's what they would do, and then the current staff that are already with the board would continue to do initial licensing, and my my complaint coordinator, who does both licensing and complaints, would go back to only doing complaints, because those are complaints from either licensees or individuals that, you know, I burned myself, or they fraudulently submitted a renewal, and we need to process those through the complaint process. That's a full-time job as well. So we're looking at getting people back to what they were doing, which is complaints, and getting at least, I would say, four people doing licensing only and answering emails. I mean, that's a part of the process, is to answer their phones and emails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So to be clear, you would envision hiring two additional receptionists and three additional folks to process applications?
That would be, that's, you know, without having, you know, the exact numbers, that would be right now at the time what I would do. I mean, and that would be the goal.
Mr. Chairman, one more question, if you'll permit me. Ms. Talsman, you referred to this earlier. When this issue first sort of got on my radar, the issue, you know, what one of your staff said was, well, we can't get to that because we have all these end-of-the-year renewals to process. And it struck me, we in Duluth license rentals. And in my time on the council, we had to cut our inspectors in half. And the way we processed it, the way we dealt with that, was if you didn't have a complaint when it came time to renew your license, you were just, and you paid your fee, you were automatically renewed until the office was able to get to you. Now, I know you referred to why you cannot do this, but it's in rule. It's not in statute that you can't. So I think the idea of going to a birth date renewal is interesting, but I also wonder, you know, why you can't just internally have smoothed out that workflow so that if there is no reason to think that a small business person is out there breaking the law or treating customers poorly, they can renew their license as a cosmetologist or a salon and just continue to do business until the inspectors can get to them.
Ms. Stoss.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman and representative of the committee, there's one way that people can actually do that is online renewals. We have online renewals, and at that point, because it is them entering their own data, we have to do a random audit after the fact. And so salons can take advantage of that. When we sent out renewals, it was very clear on the renewal stating that if you want to be processed within 5 business days, to renew online. So that option has been available for individuals and salons to do that. So it was very clear on the renewal, because the way that the online system works is it essentially does our job for us, and it processes it all, you know, automatically, and we send licenses out twice a week. They can actually check online if their license has been processed. There's an instantaneous update. They can print that out as like a temporary license and process it that way. We did tell individuals when they were renewing that there would be 4 to 6, you know, a 4 to 6 week processing time during this renewal season if you did it the paper route way. So there are individuals who do take advantage of that, but the industry itself. They're not behind computers every day all day long like myself, and they're behind the chair, and they may not just see it as a quick thing to go online and pay for it. But you guys are probably all very well aware that this is a governor initiative to do this one-stop enterprise licensing system that we're collecting a surcharge for. That's the direction that the state appears to be going at the moment with licensing and renewals of professions. So, but I would be
seems
happy.
Seems to have saved a lot of money already, all of these technological changes. Representative Reinert, were you done then?
Mr. Chair, I with your consent, I would move the A2 amendment, and I can explain to the committee a little bit.
Can I address this amendment?
We'll have Representative Reinert address the amendment first.
Oh, I'm sorry, the A2. Okay. I'm sorry.
We've already passed the other ones.
Okay.
Representative Reinert. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, the A2 amendment is meant to address the concerns that several members on this committee have heard directly from business owners. You've got an article included in your packet from a business in Hastings. When I got a copy of that article, you could have struck out this woman and her business and inserted my constituent in his business and had essentially the exact same story. If I'm on this committee going to be supportive of what Representative Clark is doing, and I appreciate her taking the initiative on this, I want to know that we're going to get some bang for our buck. And I appreciate Ms. Stoltzman answering some of the questions I had around what her staff does and what her new staff would be able to do. But I'm particularly concerned about very, very slow responses. I'm particularly concerned about rude staff. My business owner and his staff received rude responses from your staff, Ms. Stoltzman. My legislative assistant received a rude response from your staff. And frankly, when it finally got to me, I can't characterize it as anything other than cold. That's not what I would expect from
Absolutely.
Staff that are out there representing the state of
Absolutely.
Minnesota. So you have business owners walking away saying, all the state wants to do is get in my way of trying to expand my business at a time when we need small business to expand. So, members, I'd appreciate support on this amendment. It tends to go a little bit farther than I normally would want to go, but I think this case warrants it. If we're going to authorize a board to have 50% more budget, I darn well want to know that it got spent well, and I want to get reported back on how it got spent, and I want to know that these issues of customer service and slow responses were resolved. So that's what the amendment is designed to do.
Questions from the committee on the amendment? Representative Issa.
Mr. Chair, and it was actually on the bill, but it relates to the amendment as well, because it had to do with the whole online piece that I think I just actually took my renewal units for my general contractor's license last Saturday, and the information that we got this year is that there is no more face-to-face, call on the phone, paper renewals. It is online. That's the way it is. I'm sorry, but I would say cosmetologists are probably a lot more likely to be computer literate than contractors in northern Minnesota and have access to a computer. But, I mean, I think the cold reality here is this is a lot of money, in these fee increases. I paid a $10 increase in my fee for my contractor's fee this year for the transition to online service. It's a two-year fee, and then it's supposed to be over. And what we're seeing here is fees of $15, $40, $100, and I guess I'm looking at that and saying, I don't know where they came from. I agree with Representative Reinert here, I just think there's a lot of questions for accountability that I'm really struggling with, and I'm not so sure that I'm hearing that we're going about this the most efficient way. I guess my question is can't this go to online renewal, and can it reduce the need for additional staff, and can it be done more economically? That's my basic question.
Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eastland, I'm not convinced that more money is going to solve this situation. Frankly, Mr. Elsman, that's where my line of questioning went around what your staff does, where your staff is at now and what your staff does, and what other things could be done. I think there are other models out there. Going completely online, I think, is an option. Doing these renewals, taking the problem renewals first and letting the others just continue to work until you can get to them, I think, is another option as well. But, you know, committee members, when I call and can't get somebody, when I personally take time out of my, you know, my day job teaching college to make a phone call, and the message I get is this voicemail box is full, we cannot receive another message, that's frustrating. And imagine if you're the shop owner that took time out to make that phone call. This situation needs to be resolved. And what I would ask for your support on my amendment is that if the fees move forward, there's got to be accountability. There's got to be a report back. We need to know that the customer service and the slow response issues are being addressed by new dollars.
Representative Easton, just for clarification, you know these are three-year fees.
Correct, yeah. And the fees... The fees that we're paying are one-year fees for 2 years, and then they're done. And they don't already total up to what these are. So, and this isn't getting us to an online, more efficient system. This is just hiring more people, which I, you know, may be an answer, but I'm questioning whether that is the answer. And I don't know if this is true. I didn't hear it from the Department of Labor and Industry. I heard it at my continuing ed class on Saturday, where the teacher said that the department now has five people processing all the contractor licenses. Renewals. Five people. And I believe there's 14 or 15,000, you know, residential contractors. There's a whole bunch of remodeler contractors. You know, we're talking about probably 30,000 or more licenses, and they've got five people doing it. And so I guess that's my question. I look at how it happens here and how it's supposed to happen here, and I'm just seeing some things that don't seem to add up to me. So I appreciate your amendment, but I'm not sure I'm even supportive of the bill with the amendment on. I think we need to look at taking another look at and have another proposal.
Representative Mahoney.
I'm supportive of the particular amendment, but in response to what Representative Eastland said, you've been on this committee a long time with me. And if you remember how many times the Department of Labor and Industry has come to you and I as license holders over there with a surcharge, with a fee increase, with the millions of dollars they have spent on computer systems over there. And I think it was last year they came, the executive branch came and imposed another $5 or $10 onto my fee, and probably yours, to do another computer system. So, I mean, if we are asking a department or an agency to go completely online, we need to realize that it costs money up front to do that. The idea that a voice message box is full with representing the state of Minnesota absolutely should be unacceptable, totally unacceptable. The fact that they can't get through to get your license renewed or by a phone call, that's unacceptable. But don't doubt the fact that if we're asking them to go to totally online members, they're going to be back here next year looking for money to do it.
And we've spent a lot of money on this system. And Ms. Stowes, how many? Do you remember when they came over from Commerce? How many inspectors and employees were there at Commerce when Cosmetology merged with the Barber Board in an attempt to save money?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I wasn't here when the boards merged, but my understanding is Commerce had one inspector that did not transfer. I mean, they stayed at the Department of Commerce, and the Board of Cosmetology themselves had, I believe it was, two staff members, and they shared the director at that time and one barber inspector.
So we've gotten, no, the barber board was separate, so we've gone from three employees to... Now, three employees where we didn't have a huge, Representative Eastland, we've gone from three employees and where we didn't have any technology, and everything was done by, you know, script to, you know, papyrus and whatever,
Mr.
to now we have 7.3 and we're going to add 4 to 5, and we paid, how much was that computer system, do you know?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it was roughly $300,000. But can Mr. Oh, yeah. Chairman and members of the committee, and it's something Representative Easton said earlier, every year I've been in front, and since I've been here, we had the combined board, and that's what we spent a lot of time talking about, was separating it. And now that's done, and I think both boards are very happy. But what I want to say is it's been my job as the director to take a look at what or what was not done in the Department of Commerce. And so before, the agency had no board. It was within the Department of Commerce. It had an advisory committee. And every year I'm coming before you and you're hearing these problems because in some ways I feel I'm doing my job. I'm changing. We're holding people accountable for people that call us and say, well, I've done this for 9 years. I cheated for 9 years. Why are you catching me now? Well, you know, it's because we do have staff that care. We have staff. I have staff that worked every Saturday for 3 months in order to attempt to process renewals quicker. And so they came in over their 40 hours a week to do it, and they took comp time because we didn't have the budget to pay overtime. Okay, we don't want to have people come in on a Saturday. That's not what they didn't apply for a job to come every Saturday. So my staff do care, and I really feel you're getting these complaints. Yes, we can do better. We always can do better, and I apologize that you're getting terrible customer service. And with this funding, we'll be able to use another state agency. I don't remember what they're called. It's like training organization that you can contract with in the state to come and deliver different types of programs to your employees. One would be customer service. But that's why I feel I am here and you're hearing the complaints, because we are holding people accountable. We're bringing in probably over 80,000 this year in civil penalties that have never been assessed to anyone. But our inspectors are doing their job, finding the people who are working illegally, and we are bringing them to our complaint committee. They're assessing them a fine for doing what they're not supposed to be doing. This has never been done in 30 years. We have legislation that I will be hopefully bringing in front of you next year that needs to clean up really old, archaic language that's over 30 years old that doesn't apply. So I really do feel, I know I get hit a lot, but I hold my head in pride that we are doing our job and we are looking at those renewals. We can't, you had suggested to look at the problem renewals first. We can't, we sent out renewals in September. We can't tell people to mail them back right away. So we just do them as they come. So yes, the problem ones come with the good ones at the all, you know, ebbing, you know, at the same time. So
okay. Well, and, you know, I never really had. I've been here, I think, except for Representative Clark, longer than anyone on this, sitting around the table, and I never really had a big hue and cry about safety issues and that in the cosmetology area. But I understand we're trying to make it work. Maybe we can revisit it. Maybe as we pass this tonight, we can look at a sunset in these fees, Representative Eastland, just to see how they were used or something. So we'll look at that. Representative Anderson, just to the amendment?
Not to the amendment.
Can we vote on the amendment?
Yep.
Okay. You've heard the proposal. Any more questions on the amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Representative Anderson, let's wrap it up. I need a haircut.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Dalsman. Tell me again on the piece, your current budget is $651. How much of that goes to salaries?
Gina.
One other question.
Mr. Chairman and members of committee, I don't have that exact amount with me at the moment. I would say we'd be looking in the 70% range. But I could provide it back to the assistant of the exact percentage.
We'll be holding this over, so
you can get that information. Mr. Chair, Ms. Dalsman. You said that you did 80,000 in civil penalties this last year, I think you said. Does that go directly to you as an entity, or does it go to the state general fund? Where does that money go?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that's the anticipated what we would collect totally, so it's not what we have today. That would stay in the state's general fund. I don't believe we're allowed to – well, we get an appropriation, but you're not allowed to generate support your agency by fining people, because there could be an idea you're going to fine people to keep employees, and that we can't do that. So
wait,
now
that's how we run the whole criminal justice.
Yeah,
what the hell you talking about?
Well, so
you got a cop got to arrest you to make his car payment. The judge got to sentence you to make his house payment.
But they stay in the state's general fund. they don't increase our appropriation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beeson.
Is that kind of what we're doing here? Is we're fighting people to fund the agency? Yeah.
Okay. We're going to look at this as we set it aside, but we've got the bill as amended with three amendments, and so we'll look at these a little closer on that. Representative Clark removes the motion that House File 3517, as amended, just be laid over for possible inclusion. We don't need to vote on it. Thank you, Gina. And so am I saying your name wrong, or is everybody else saying your name wrong? Isn't it Stouse?
You're correct, Mr. Chairman. I have a cold, so maybe it didn't come out right.
We put an M.
I can change it to my married name. It's maybe a little easier, so fast, like you're, you know, running down the fast down the road. But we'll stay with Stouse so you guys don't forget me every year.
Okay, thank you. And now, final bill, Representative Loeffler. And Representative Clark moves House File 3133. We recommend it to pass, and I believe... Is there a fiscal note here?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Representative Loeffler, what do you prefer to have this bill just out to the general
fund? I believe this can go to the general fund after we, I'm back on fiscal notes in the back of my head. After we adopt a couple of amendments that will greatly narrow the focus of the bill. And as the second amendment's being handed out, I'll just explain what the two together will do. You have the DE amendment.
Well, first of all, Representative Clark moves the DE2, which is the delete all amendment, to the bill. So all of us in favor, that's getting the bill into.
The bill
is in the packet.
Paper put together?
No.
An extra copy.
Let's put it in the Democrat.
My 15-minute break.
You don't get it. Get back here. How did you vote on that, Representative? Okay, we have the DE2 amendment, which is what we're going to be working off of, members, because it's a delete also. Representative Clark just moves the substitution of the DE2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. And now we have the DE2 amendment before we explain the move the other amendment. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What the DE2 amendment did was it removed the provisions related to workers' compensation, and what the A1 amendment, which I would hope that someone would now move, will do is drop the provisions related to unpaid military leave related to a domestic partner.
Okay. Representative Lai then moves the A1 amendment and to the delete all DE2 amendment, which will basically then put the bill in the shape you want.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
So Representative Lai moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Loeffler, your bill's just gotten a lot smaller.
Isn't that nice? as amended, this bill is basically a final paycheck bill. If you check out, that is, you die while you're still owed a payment by an employer, current law provides that that payment of that check would go to the surviving spouse. The bill before you would provide the same treatment to a same-sex domestic partner if the deceased has previously identified that person to the employer. I've talked with a range of employer representatives, and they have no problem with it as it is now amended. And I think all of us know how difficult it is to lose someone unexpectedly in life, whether it's a spouse or a longtime domestic partner. This just provides for that final paycheck after the employer's been notified as to who should be receiving that in the interest of the person who has passed away. And with that, I have Jane Bauman. She's a board member with Project 515 here, who's available to give testimony or respond to questions.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Committee Chair and members, my name is Jane Bauman, B-O-W-M-A-N. I'm happy to be here. I know it's been a long meeting for you, so I appreciate your attention. I am on the board of Project 515. Project 515 is a nonprofit organization we have identified at least 515 state statutes that discriminate against same-sex couples and their families. Our mission is narrow. It is to reduce the number, 515, down to zero, so that Minnesota law treats same-sex partners and their families exactly the same as their married counterparts. Thank you to Representative Loeffler for bringing this bill forward. I think she explained the bill well, and I'm available for questions if anybody has any.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, I can't remember what you said in the beginning, but do you have a fiscal note for this at all?
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I don't believe there's any fiscal note. Currently, under current law, the employer is required to pay any payment that is owed to the deceased. It would go through the estate process if there wasn't a spouse. This just makes it easier when a person has designated their domestic partner to be the person as their survivor.
Thank you.
Okay. Other further questions then?
Mr. Chair. We could have a roll call vote on this, please.
Sure. Representative Anderson requests a roll call vote on House File 3133 as amended with the DE2 amendment and the delete all and then the A1 amendment. Clerk will take the roll.
Bukovina?
Yes.
Anderson?
No.
Atkins? Why?
Yes.
Reinert?
Yes.
Clark?
Yes.
Detmer?
No.
Downey? Eastland?
No.
Gunther? Hawes?
Yes.
Mahoney?
Yes.
McFarlane? Murphy? Nornis? Norton? Obermuller?
Yes.
Poppy?
Aye.
Reinert?
Yes.
Slocum?
Yes.
Welty?
The bill is passed and referred to the House floor. Members, anything else? If not, the meeting is adjourned. Members, one last thing, if I could, before, and I know it's a long night. We're only over 10 minutes. I just wanted to say, you know, I've kind of reluctantly given up on my Mead bill this year, and I have to say that I'm very disappointed in doing so because I did have an amendment. And I have a way to pay for it, and it's probably, you know, not going to be supported by most of the members on the other side of the aisle, but it was going to be to raise the cap now from, I think it's 27, Ms. Newman, 28,000 to 35 to bring in some extra money to run the program. I wasn't going to raise the percentage on that displaced worker amount. So that's how I was going to do it, members. If some of you really want me to move forward on this, and I know Representative Clark has this bill in one of her bills somewhere.
Well, actually, it was in
Representative Mariani's bill.
Yeah,
I think.
It was in Representative Mariani's bill.
But you know, last year I tried to move it forward, and I just want you to know that little pilot program we put on the range with some taconite dollars has now had, I think, 87 people that have taken advantage, 87 businesses, or excuse me, 43 businesses have hired 87 people, and another 40 businesses have requested to hire 127 people. And the program has worked out quite well. And it's a lot of different organizations from law firms and a hardwood company to a refrigeration company and different even retail stores. So it's worked good. I won't waste our time, I guess, because I don't know even where my side of the aisle stands on putting that cap up a little bit to raise that money. But I'm a disappointed in myself, really, because I think these times really call for some type of subsidy, but you know, I see a representative from the AFL-CIO, and they haven't given me a lot of help either, those union thugs. So, you know, that's good, but that's where it sits right now. Maybe I'll throw it out there when we're putting the omnibus bill together and give everybody an opportunity to beat me up one more time.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
Well, I just want to thank you for bringing the bill forward at all. I think it's a fabulous bill. I mean, I was around when it was used in the 80s and made a lot of difference for a lot of small businesses in particular. Is the issue the cap? That's what's stopping it? What the level of the cap?
I just don't think it'll get signed and it'll just get vetoed. And, and I don't know if the time to do it. There's time to take a stand, and I'd really like to take a stand on other parts of our omnibus bill where I want to take a stand. Mm-hmm. But this, you've got to make a decision on how many stands you want to take. How many lines you want to draw in the sand. So, members, tomorrow we're meeting, remember, at 5:30 in 400 South to get it, or North. I think Representative Anderson has some bills and others, so. Okay, with that, meeting adjourned.